The Joint Committee of Ways and Means to order for February 20th, 2008. We've got some huge bills on our agenda, much of which we've discussed in our October and January Ways and Means meetings. However, as the members here know and the audience knows, there's also some new additions that we're going to be discussing in more detail. Hopefully we will not spend a lot of time on stuff we've already agreed upon and approved unless there's some new rethinking that has to happen because we've got a lot of work to do today. Having said that, as is our new custom, we're going to entertain some public testimony for about half an hour or so. We've got a sign-up sheet here that has people on it, so I'd ask people to confine. I'm going to be real strict on the time limits today because we just don't have a lot of time, and I apologize. I want everyone to have a chance to talk. That's the reason for that. So we're going to limit to probably 3 minutes max. Two would be preferred if there's a way you can do that. We just need to get moving along here. So with that, let's open the public testimony portion of the hearing and get we'll have you come up three at a time, please. Craig Hostetler, John Mullen, and Carol Henkel, please.
I'll give you time.
Thank you. Please start right in, one of you.
Thank you, co-chairs Schrader and Nolan, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in front of you, in particular on House Bill 3614 that you're going to be considering. I want to thank you for considering funding this bill. It is an important bill that's had a lot of work that's gone into it. In particular, I did want to point out a couple things. One, on page one, that the 6 to 12 month minimum requirement for enrollment be considered. And at some point, this is very important to get children continuing on the Oregon Health Plan. And I know this is a big item that you're considering within the bill, and it is important to the group that's worked on this. The second piece of this is, as you roll out the collaborative section of the bill, that it's very important to keep the language within the collaborative section of the bill on page two that really kind of establishes what these demonstration projects will be. This language has been vetted amongst a variety of groups, and there's been some buy-in. We've included legislators, various key stakeholders in the healthcare community to really come up with this language. And if it's lost, then the demonstration projects can go in different ways. So that's another piece I just wanted to highlight. And I'm going to keep it short.
Very good. Thank you. Could you identify yourself for the record again?
My name is Craig Hostetler from the Oregon Primary Care Association.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, and I wonder if I could indulge you, Mr. Co-chair, to have my co-chair come up. We signed up together, and if we split our time into 2 minutes total,
certainly.
So Kathy Kaufman. While she's coming up, just would say that the Human Services Coalition is a statewide organization. We are made up of membership of about 60 different organizations and individuals concerned about human services. We thought very carefully about this session about what we would support, and we took a look at housing, long-term care, and health care issues. And Kathy's going to speak about the health care bill. But a couple of things that I will mention is Senate Bill 1061, the long-term care bill, that basically looks at where we are as a state, which is the significant achievements we have made, the crisis that exists in community-based care rates, and where we need to go in the future. So we're very supportive of that, knowing that the fiscal in 1061 has been taken out, and it's to be part of the discussion about the DHS rebalance. I would also state that the Human Services Coalition is very much in favor of making sure that the rebalance stays within DHS for purposes of serving the clients of the Department of Human Services. Rick's mentioned Senate Bill 1073, which is the Housing Alliance, worked on that with Senator Johnson. We're very much in supportive of affordable housing for Oregonians. This is something that's a cross-cutting issue for all human service programs, so we encourage you to do what you can around that particular issue. And before turning it over to Kathy, there's another bill that we talked about supporting, but there was a timing issue with it, and it didn't work out, and that's Senate Bill 1075. And I testified on that personally, and that is the task force for the for mental health for the underserved, Senator Gordley's bill. We understand that there's no fiscal on that, that the department can absorb that. While the Human Services Coalition didn't take a position, it was really a matter of timing. I believe that ultimately there are just many, many people supportive of having a thorough discussion about the people who are underserved in the mental health system. So with that, I'll end my testimony and just thank you, and we hope that you can give consideration to these issues.
Thank you. Ms. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Madam Co-Chair, for the record, my name is Kathy Kaufman. I am the Co-Chair for the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, as well as the Policy Director for Children First for Oregon. And I'm here to testify to the importance of House Bill 3614. I strongly urge you to hear more about this bill, specifically concerned about making sure that we increase enrollment for the poverty-level Medicaid children from 6 months to 12 months continuously. I think given where we started, where we were at the start of this biennium, around with our hopes for improving children's health coverage, it would be an incredible shame if at the end of the biennium we are no better off than we were at the start of it. So I appreciate your consideration, and I strongly urge you to consider this bill. Bearing in mind the resource constraints, it's imperative that we cover the limited number of children we can cover. We cover them all continuously. And if enrollment needs to be contained, short enrollment periods are not the appropriate way to do it. Thank you again for your consideration.
Thank you. Good testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I also have someone with me to testify, Marianne Holzer. Is it okay if she comes up?
Yes, sir. The other two would step
Thank
down.
You.
Thank you.
I also have written testimony that I'd like to submit.
Excellent. Tom Holzer, want to come up too, as long as he's there?
Again, my name is Carol Heinkel. I'm from Eugene. I live six blocks from the site of the proposed U of O basketball arena that is on your agenda in Senate Bill 5555 and House Bill 5100 today. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present these comments. And please accept these comments in addition today to the letter dated February 18th that I submitted with my husband, along with two petitions that were signed by over 100 people in our area. My comments will be brief. I will leave more detail to the written comments, and I'm available for questions. I'd like to start by saying that this is not a NIMBY request. My neighbors and I are very well accustomed to institutional uses in our area. We're very used to working with the university, and we accept that. We accept the benefits as well as the costs of living where we live. This request is for you to require that the university revise the arena proposal to one that fits in this rural Oregon environment and includes a budget for parking and for addressing the impacts on the Fairmount neighborhood. The arena as proposed is too big and expensive to be viable in this rural Oregon community. The arena is a risky proposition, especially with the imminent threat of recession. Net revenue projections are based on unreliable assumptions and incomplete information. Ticket prices and assessments will be too high and will produce lower revenue than projected. The proposal does not include a budget for parking. The people who we petitioned readily offered to us that they oppose this strongly. And they oppose it not because it's in our neighborhood, but because it's too big, it's too expensive, and it's ill-conceived. And that those petitions, again, were signed by over 100 people readily. So we respectfully request that you, our elected representatives, protect our quality of life and protect our academic programs in our university from future liability from this oversized, misplaced project. Please require the university to present a more viable project with more realistic revenue and cost assessments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mary Ann Holzer, 37 years, and thank you for having the opportunity to talk to you. I'm a 37-year resident of the Fairmont area, and we have great concern about the construction of a $200 million gigantic arena, the most expensive in the country, adjacent to a beautiful historic neighborhood. 130 neighbors have signed petitions of concern. These are the things we worry about. Disregard, and I'm very concerned about this, of previous citizen university and neighborhood planning. We have a neighborhood plan, the 2003 plan. This was approved by the city of Eugene. This was not consulted in planning this, and it conflicts. We will be appealing through a conditional use process on this. This plan is incompatible with the neighborhood. It's a gigantic footprint, and it will overwhelm craftsmen's houses, small businesses, and infill apartments planned for a mixed-use development that was to be there and has already been approved. There will be a destructive impact of crowds regularly attending events in a 10,500-seat arena. Parking would need 2,800 spaces. There is no approved yet plan for a parking of any kind, although there have been references to some. Cars will flood the residential streets. On-campus parking is proposed to be a backup, but it is totally insufficient, particularly in the evenings and afternoons. Noise, litter, and disorderly behavior. South University neighbors who have lived next to Mack Court for some time testify frequently that their property values go down, that there isn't adequate policing, traffic is in their neighborhood, and litter. In questioning the planners of this project, we have been told that as far as we know, there is no policing planned, except possibly volunteer, for the crowds. People entering and exiting will be noisy, they will be excited, and there may be disorderly conduct. There certainly has been around Mack Court. We are told that volunteer organizations might be asked to come and clean up, which they do occasionally for football games, and get money paid to their organizations. I'm not sure that will be effective in a arena of this size. Carol has talked about the financing. The income from ticket fees, special seats, and big donors are expected to make the project pay for itself. If this does not happen, will the donor funds make up the difference? If not, where would it go? Well, it would go to the university budget, which would then have to use what they had to possibly reduce other programs, athletic as well as academic. But eventually, state taxpayers would be the responsible for any kind of increase in debt payments that we couldn't make, and they are being raised.
Could you summarize, Ms. Holzer? I'm sorry.
In summary, this permanent plan project rushed through an emergency session without modifications in size, income projection, and impact studies has the potential to put the university, the state, and an important city asset, the neighborhood of the university, at serious risk. Some people are calling it a boondoggle.
Thank you very much. Mr. Holzer.
Yes, good afternoon. I am respectfully submitting an official two-page letter here from the Fairmont Neighborhood Association, which was written about 2 weeks ago and unanimously voted on last night. Due to the shortness of time, I'll just read you two short paragraphs at
the
end.
Thank you, sir.
As we sum up the letter that you all will have there, if we say here, the university wants taxpayers to ultimately bear the risk of 30-year bonds that may also limit the availability, the university's system ability to fund other capital projects or jeopardize the state's bond rating. In these uncertain economic times, it is paramount that U.S. legislatures representing the interests of the entire state make certain the project can proceed on a solid fiscal footing before approving a historic request for state bonds that transfers all of the risk to the taxpayers of Oregon. And lastly, we would like to request additionally, the Paramount Neighborhood Association has requested that if the bonds are approved, that a budget note be attached to the approval that requests the University of Oregon adequately address all the potential impacts of the arena, including but not necessarily limited to traffic impacts, parking, litter, security, noise, and financial impacts. And thank you very much.
Excellent testimony. Thank you for making the trip.
Thank you.
Let's get Michael Mumaw, Doris Penwell, and Patty Whitney Weiss up, please. Please begin.
Co-Chair Schrader, Representative Nolan, thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding House Bill 3626. My name is Michael Mumaw. I am the Emergency Manager for the City of Beaverton. Today I'm before you as President of the Oregon Emergency Management Association, which is a professional association for the emergency management community in Oregon, and we represent over 300 members across the state and as a cross-section of the emergency management profession. House Bill 3626, Sections 4 and 5, propose a confusing solution to a non-existing problem. The proposed Dash 8 amendments before you today also do nothing to relieve our association's concerns. House Bill 3626, Sections 4 and 5, and the proposed amendments do not provide any assurance that the jurisdictions that are awarded federal pre-disaster mitigation grants or public assistance funds after disaster will receive the full amount that they are due. It also further does not provide any assurance that the added administrative requirements will not delay the receipt of these funds. OEMA requests that House Bill 3626 only be moved forward if Sections 4 and 5 are removed from the bill. OEMA also urges this Oregon legislature to pass and fully fund House Bill 3607A engrossed, which is much needed legislation establishing the Oregon Declared Emergency Recovery Fund that would greatly benefit the citizens of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity again to testify today.
Very concise. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here to discuss the Dash 8 amendments to 3607, which came from the concept that was in House Bill 2607. Those provisions established the local disaster assistance account. The Association of Oregon Counties is in support of that proposal, not that it's perfect, but it establishes the fund that is so badly needed. It is a provision that has been needed for a long time for disasters, and it is something that the federal government will look favorably upon Oregon for establishing. The bill itself doesn't establish a mechanism for funding of the program, but it at least gets the first thing done, which is establishing the program. One provision in the bill and the amendments to Dash 8 discuss the awards from the fund, which are termed loans in disasters. That's sometimes very difficult to get to, but I assume and I'm hopeful that the administrators of the fund will understand that if you establish the provisions in administrative rule that make it flexible so that you can have longer loans, lower interest rates, maybe forgivable loans for some kinds of things that are absolutely necessary, but that would make it very doable for the local governments and the entities in the community. So usually loan programs have some element that may be grant, but in this case, this bill does not do that. But on the other hand, the bill is left for that the terms are developing rule, and we'll work very closely with the military department to make that happen. So
in summary, we are in support of the bill and appreciate that there is a local disaster assistance review board that works with the department to develop all of this. Thanks a lot.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Watts.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I'm here today to talk about House Bill 3614. I'm concerned to hear that the provision to extend benefits from 6 to 12 months is being taken off the table. And if I could be frank, it feels to us like numbers are trumping lives here. We're willing, as a legislature and a state, to allow the Connect to for businesses for another $100 million hit to our budget with the stimulus package, and yet we're not willing to provide 12 months worth of enrollment for our poorest children in health care that has no cost this biennium and, yes, has a roll-up. But I believe we really will spend more in the long run if we delay this. These children are going to go to the emergency rooms. They're going to miss more school days, which means they're not going to get the education that they need in order to succeed and be those workers that our businesses need. I would really urge that you reconsider this particular provision and fund it now, because these children really count on it. And without it, I can guarantee you there will be more hungry children in the state as well, as those families struggle to pay for health care. Thank you.
Thank you. Good testimony. Very good testimony. Let's go to Senator Flicker, General Caldwell, and Mr. Meese is back again.
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. There are 18 electric cooperatives in Oregon that serve the most rural parts of the state. We serve 65% of the state geographically, and we only serve 10% of the population. We are in a situation where density is a huge issue for us, and we only serve less than 6 customers per mile of line. So we have issues that other utilities in the state do not have. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3626, simply to say a couple of things. One, we do need a disaster relief fund in the state. I have, since a picture's worth a thousand words, what I handed out to you are some pictures from West Oregon Electric Cooperative. This is a small cooperative that serves the northwest portion of Oregon, has the most trees of any utility, probably in the world. They are subject to continual disasters because of weather issues, because of the number of trees that they have. Prior to the December storm, a week prior, in fact, they lost 7 miles of their transmission line to metal thieves. Following that, a week later, they were hit by the storm, and as you can see from those pictures, their office was flooded out, their substation was flooded out, and they lost their transmission line. This is a utility that has the highest rates in the state of Oregon for any electricity utility in the state. They are double, frankly, of what any other electricity ratepayer pays. Because electric cooperatives are private, not-for-profit utilities, we are not subject to government funding at all. And West Oregon Electric is looking at an $8 million deficit to put their system back to where it is a reliable system that can serve the members of that cooperative in that part of the state. A disaster relief fund, hopefully, would provide some additional funding in areas like this where there are not a lot of other options. A couple things that I would like to get on the record, because I'm really here just to support the bill, but I would hope that there would be an opportunity to have community representatives on a review team. I think it's critically important that when a review team is put together that there are not only just government representatives, but there are members of the community that serve private entities. Also, I would hope that the money that there's a possibility that the money could be designated to put back together an infrastructure that is critical to the economic health of a community. And so I'm hoping that that money could be passed on to something like a small electric cooperative who really has no other source of funding except for some FEMA money, which they have to match, and they have to look to the ratepayers. And with electricity rates that are twice any electricity ratepayers in the state, they've got to find some place to find $8 million. Otherwise, it's totally on the backs of their customers. So I ask that you support a disaster relief fund for Oregon. I ask that if we get such a fund, that when it comes time to put together the details of how that is administrated, that there is an opportunity for community involvement and there is an opportunity to pass this money on to infrastructure repair in that community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. General?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. You've heard my testimony on this bill more than once. We support the bill. However, we've asked for some changes. Previously, they don't seem to be able to get him through the minor, but they're, I think, significant in the sense of how we execute it. On page 2, line 14, it says the review board shall include, colon, and we believe we should say, but not limited to. So we will have this local review board body that can be expanded if the case deemed it appropriate. We suggest that language. On the same page, on line 27, it says the Oregon Military Department shall adopt rules establishing, colon, and we would recommend that in that line, it said the Oregon Emergency Management Department under the Oregon Military Department shall establish rules. Because we make regulations, OEM makes rules. So be clear that way. Yeah? So those are two comments I want to get on the record. I suspect there'll be other changes to this little bill before we're out of here. So when it goes back to the next
blue point of rethink, I would appreciate that.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary J. Ness, Washington County. I have a question. I was here Monday, and I was able to speak. Was that on record?
Yes, sir.
As it was in recess, so it was on record? I'll make my comments very brief then.
Please.
I did not know that. We had some very fine testimony by three people regarding the arena. I would only like to add what I had said Monday. It seems that those people are in the same situation that I am. You look and the figures don't seem to match, and it appears that we have a gift. While it's rather generous, it appears that we are once again taking different buckets to dip out of the same well, and they brought up that point also. I would only like to close by saying that a sudden decision may not be the right decision, and that I think that we need to look at these facts, and a special session is not the time to approve such a large bond in such a different manner than has ever been done before. I thank you for the time, and appreciate my testimony Monday.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you all.
That's all we had. Who signed up? We have a document from Executive Director of NAMI Oregon that we're going to pass out for the record. Ask my colleagues to look at it on the state hospital. Is there anyone else in the audience that did not get a chance to sign up that needed to testify today? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony portion of the agenda. Colleagues, we're going to work a little out of order here. I'm going to give you the order that we're going to go through these bills. Bill number one will be House Bill 5100, the Bonding Authority. The next on the docket will be 5555, the Capital Construction. That'll be number two. Then we'll go to 5556, the Budget Reconciliation Bill. Then number four, and it will be 3626, the Program Change Bill, and the last will be Senate Bill 1069. So that's the new order there, so we can all stay engaged.
And then, Mr. Co-Chair, we've added two bills.
At the end of the agenda, we have the rest of the agenda flows as we have before. As you notice, it's a revised agenda with 1093 and 1099 at the bottom of our hearing schedule. right, let's start with Senate Bill 5555. I think staff has some cheat sheets for us to work through so we don't have to go through the extensive language in the bill before us. Oh, excuse me, 5100. I apologize for that. They're talking like 5100. Pardon me, 5100. I misspoke. Staff, you want to start us off here?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, before we get started on this, there is an issue that has arisen related to lottery bonds, and Jack Kenny from the Department of Administrative Services is here.
That's a good idea, yeah.
And if you would like, he could come forward and discuss that issue with you. And
Briefly, Mr. Kenny, please, if you don't mind. Salient point. We're here. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Darren. I want to apprise you of the situation with our lottery bond program. Typically, of course, I wouldn't talk to you about bond insurance in a setting such as this. However, there is a potential that I may need to be before you again in January. The situation is it could result in potential delay of funding certain projects that were approved by this body in the last legislative session. The lottery bond indenture, which is the agreement between bondholders and the state of Oregon, includes a requirement that we have either a cash reserve or a surety provider that to provide this protection for bondholders. If we don't use the surety provider, we have to have the fund cash reserved, and it's typical that we use the surety provider. The surety provider for the lottery bond program is a company called AMBAC, and unfortunately, like many but not all bond insurers, AMBAC has been affected by the recent financial market turmoil. They have been downgraded by Fitch Investor Services to AA and on a negative credit watch at this time. This is a very important situation, so the Insurance Commissioner of New York has actually put together a consortium of banks, is coordinating a consortium of banks to address the situation, hopefully to provide needed capital to AMBAC and other bond insurers so that they will not be downgraded. Now, our lottery bond program is a very strong and stable program. It's rated AAA by Standard & Poor's, AA by Moody's. So you may wonder why is it important that AMBAC is facing a potential downgrade and has been downgraded by Fitch. The bond indenture, as I mentioned, the agreement between the bondholders and the state of Oregon, requires that our surety provider maintain a rating of AA or better by Standard & Poor's and Moody's. Moody's has indicated that they will wait until the Insurance Commissioner of New York and the bank consortium put together have an opportunity to rectify the situation before they make a decision on the rating of AMBAC. Basically, Moody's has given this consortium to the end of this month.
Mr. Kenny, yes. We're going to have to really summarize this in English for some of us country folk here.
Okay.
So I understand we've got problems. Security companies are in trouble. That's the mechanism we use to back a lot of our debt issuance this time. Instead of using reserves, gave us more money to hopefully spend. But we have a problem because that company's in trouble. So we have a new plan to deal with our reservation issues. And that plan is?
Well, that plan is that we will get insurance from another surety provider, such as FSA or one of the other ones, FSA or Associated Guarantee. That is our plan. We hope to do that. We think it's very likely that we will be able to do that, but there's potential that we may not be able to do that.
So,
and in that event, we have sold bonds already in the fall of 2007. We would need to provide a cash reserve for that, which would require us to sell about $1.9 million in lottery bonds to cover that reserve. It would also, if we are unable to obtain insurance, we would also have to cash fund reserves for the remainder of the lottery sales. We do not have sufficient bond authority to do that now, so I would be before you again in January of 2009 when the next legislature convenes with a recommendation or looking for direction from you as to which projects might either be deferred or eliminated or to give us additional bond authority to cash fund the reserves.
because the number, do we understand, we may have to delay a few projects if we can't get another insurer by the end of the biennium. We're being very prudent here. Thank you. Very good report.
Chair.
Question? Yes, Senator Monroe.
Are we going to have any additional information prior to the next session, like for the e-board maybe in June or one of our other e-board meetings?
I would be happy, Senator, Chair Schrader, Senator Monroe, I'd be happy to prepare information, particularly if the situation deteriorates to the point where we are unable to obtain another bond insurer.
That would be very appropriate.
I'd like to have that.
Somebody would like that, I think. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is, you mentioned at the beginning that this relates to the instability of the financial markets.
Yes.
Is that related to mortgage lending?
Chair Schrader, Nolan, Representative Nathanson, yes. Primarily, the financial difficulties that AMBAC is experiencing are due to insuring mortgage-backed securities.
Thank you. My second question is, when you come back to us with more information, I'd like to hear what it's going to cost the state to just deal with the situation. For example, is there a cost to us to go out and find someone else to do this insuring and help us back our investments?
Representative Nathanson, we always do a analysis before we buy bond insurance as to whether or not it's cost effective. If the improved price of the bonds is not greater than the cost of the insurance policy, then we will not purchase the insurance. So it must meet that financial test.
I'd like to clarify.
Okay.
Thank you. That is very useful information. I'd also like to know just what it's costing us to deal with the situation that we didn't plan on it. It's taking staff time, and it will take some resources to just deal with what was imposed on us. Is this negligible? Is this something that the department can handle without taking away resources from some other project that we needed to work on?
Chair Schrader, Representative Davidson, I think the short answer to that is yes. As I mentioned in my testimony, there is the potential that we might have to sell an additional $1.9 million.
Thank you.
Very good. Let's move ahead here, colleagues. And I think that just for information purposes, particularly as an audience, you know, some of the bills that were testified on here today, the bills themselves may or may not move forward, but you'll see elements of those bills in some of the suggestions by our staff today. So please take note. Also, you'll see that while some of the projects may or may not move forward, because of the public testimony we received both here and through our constituencies, you'll see some amendments brought forward to make sure that we're doing as judicious and fiscally responsible administration of our capital and bonding projects as we possibly can. Last thing I'd say is that it's the intention of the chairs to have our staff present the new information to you, and then they will prepare amendments that reflect what we decide, and we will vote on these bills to move them forward tomorrow. Okay? So we have time. Staff needs time to move the paperwork, quite frankly. Mr. Hill.
Sure, Mr. Coacher, if I might. The handout that I've given you for House Bill 5100, and just for the record, House Bill 5100 establishes the additional amounts of authority for state agencies to issue bonds and certificates of participation with third-party financing agreements and the amount of revenue state agencies may raise from such issuances. It should be noted that these revenues end up in the agency's budget. But the handout that I've given you for House Bill 5100 actually has a number of items on it. Some of them are highlighted in yellow, and those would be the items that the committee has not officially approved yet. Before Mr. Kinney gets too comfortable over there, he may want to come forward and discuss the top one here called Other Financing of $5 Million. If you recall last session, there was a COP issuance, actually an authority for $7.5 million of other financing. And I'll let Jack explain more of exactly what that's used for. They're asking for an increase of that of another $5 million. The rest of the items that under DAS have all been approved, and I have added the dates here so that you can see when the committee took action on those. The other three items that have not been approved by the committee yet are for the Judicial Department, the e-court system, for the Department of Higher Education, the OIT Health Center, the Phase 2 portion, and for community colleges and workforce development, the Clatsop Community College, $4 million.
Very good. Mr. Cuny, briefly, please.
All right. Thank you, Chair Schrader and Chair Nolan. Yes, I'm here to advocate for the additional $5 million in other financing agreements. Every year in the bond bill, there's an amount for COPs and other financing agreements. Typically, an agency, when it builds its budget, its capital budget, it doesn't know the form of the transaction necessarily on how they're going to acquire equipment. Sometimes that includes capital leases. Capital leases are, in effect, borrowing, and because they are borrowing, they require approval by the legislature, and they do require COP and other financing agreement authority. So typically what we're talking about here is capital leases. Again, so I think an important point here is this $5 million doesn't provide additional authority in an agency's budget or limitation in the budget. All it does is provide authority to do a capital lease or other financing agreement type of transaction. So if that's the best business decision for an agency to make, it does require authority to do this. Now, typically, the $7.5 million that was in the budget for other financing agreements is sufficient. We've done 44 other financing agreements over the course of the program. They ranged in value from $5 million to just over $120,000. We did have a potential opportunity and still have a potential opportunity at one of the university systems, the Nanoscience Technology Institute, where there's some large scientific equipment at an attractive price. And it potentially, the best way to do this transaction might be through an other financing agreement. This could be somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 to $11 million. Again, the agency would have to have that money in its budget to spend, but without the requisite authority in the bond bill for other financing agreements, it wouldn't be able to make this, it wouldn't be able to conduct this transaction or transact this business in this way.
Good. Very good, good explanation. Chair Nolan.
I just want to clarify. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Kenny, as this has been explained to me in listening to your comment today, it is my understanding that this action will not in any way increase general fund expenditure to support previously approved projects. Am I correct in that understanding?
Co-Chair Nolan, that is correct.
Thank you.
I'm kind of lost in this. So what are we talking about here? Increasing a limitation or actually transferring funds?
Mr. Kenny.
Chair Schrader, Representative Morgan, this simply increases authority that's granted within the bond bill. All authority to borrow money by any state agency must be approved within the bond bill. And so this simply increases the ceiling, if you will, or the limit on the amount of authority that all state agencies have for financing.
Okay, so it doesn't actually require a transfer of dollars.
Chair Schrader, Representative Morgan, that is correct.
Thank you.
Good questions, good clarifications. All right, just for the sake of our staff who's going to be drafting amendments, any further issues or concerns? Excuse me, Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I'm familiar with everything on this except the item of Clatsop Community College. Could we get some information about what that?
So we'll work right down the list.
Okay.
We'll work right down the list. And that's all I'm talking about. The first item we just talked about, the $5 million. That's what I meant. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. Doesn't seem like there's any objection, staff. How about the e-courts?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this has been discussed in this committee on several occasions. The 24440 is the latest number that we have to accomplish that during that project for the current biennium. If you have further questions, we could have staff who's much more knowledgeable than I am come up here and discuss it with you, but we would like to have approval.
We did talk about that. Further discussion about that? Members need any clarification? Seeing none, I guess that one would be all right. Owen, we've already talked about that. We've already had a good hearing and discussion on that. Let's go to, we should probably discuss the University of Oregon Arena, I think, again. I think we've already approved it. There's some other suggestions here. You want to talk about that, or do we want to have Mr. Bender? Well, we don't. Let's skip over that for right now. I need my chair on that one, too. And let's go to down to the Department of Higher Education, the Oregon Institute of Technology, the Health Center.
Mr. Chair, again, this item has been discussed before this committee. We're just seeking your approval so we can add it to the bill.
Any discussion on that item? Any objection at this point to adding OIT to the bonding bill?
Okay.
All right, we get to represent Parkinson in a hurry. Let's talk about Clatsop Community College.
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid I don't have much information on this one. Is Steve not here? Okay. Mr. Chair, there's seeking $4 million of Article 11G bonds for Clatsop Community College. We'll hang on here 1 second.
It's ramming and falling down, and we need to do something about it.
The building is that's really good testimony.
I would think so.
Yes.
I think on this piece that Clatsop Community College was number one in the queue among the priority items as listed by the Community College Association. I think we've talked about this in prior ways and means venues, and that this is simply as I understand it, in the beginning, we probably would have funded this in the end of the last session had they been able to get their side of the deal put together. But it looks to me like now they must have gotten that together, and this is the same project, number one in the queue for the community college group of projects.
Yes, that is accurate. Mr. Bender, you want to
take a breath?
Well, I'll talk for a few minutes then, and Mr. Bender can correct it. Representative Hanna is absolutely correct. There was a concern by the committee and the co-chairs in particular about a bonding ceiling limit, if you will, for community colleges. And at one of our previous meetings, we talked about getting higher education community colleges together in the interim going forward to 09 and trying to develop what would hopefully be some sort of general agreement about types of projects and debt service and bonding limits that the legislature could entertain in a fiscally responsible way going forward. And that way the community colleges and university system could really develop proposals that had an excellent chance of passing muster, if you will, at the state legislature, and there'd be more coordination between the governor's office, the legislature, and our partners in the educational community. Having said that, Clatsop had been at the altar in a previous session. We were trying to make sure there was rotation. They did not have all their ducks in a row. They have since done much better. There's still a little bit to go, as I understand that. We also have asked them to, if they wouldn't mind, a budget note that actually delineated that this would be recognized as a $4 million advance on the bonding authority for 09-11. To put it more clearly, realizing we have a rotation to go through, trying to stay to the bonding ceilings with maybe a little inflationary adjustment, would it be okay with the Community College Association, at least someone in the Department of Community College Workforce Development, and of course the president of Clatsop Community College himself, if we acknowledge the fact that we're trying to keep this rotation, ergo there'd be a rough $42 million bonding target for next session, and this would account $4 million towards that target, so we'd have roughly $38 million of bonding authority in 09-11 for the Community College Association and everyone to develop ideas around. And recognizing there are several colleges that haven't gotten anything yet, and I would hope they'd be right up there at the top after this Clatsop Community College. So we actually have a letter already from the Community College Association, which we can distribute to everyone here, and hopefully be getting the minutes shortly, so we'll have that information tomorrow. Mr. Bender, if you've caught your breath, would you like to add anything much more salient?
No, I did not catch Representative Hanna's additional question, and if he has any remaining questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Further discussion then, I guess? Concerns? Yes, Senator Bates.
Not concerns, just a couple statements, if I could real quickly. Both these projects are extremely important to rural Oregon and to all of Oregon, especially the OIT project, which draws students from all over the state for what end up being very high-paying jobs. And so I appreciate you moving these both forward. It also, from my point of view, points out very clearly the difference between 11G and 11F bonds, so we're going to take up here in a few minutes. These are general obligation bonds that are being backed up by tax dollars for a very good purpose, education of Oregonians. And I think people in this room hopefully will remember that as we go through this, that 11G and 11F bonds are very, very different. and the difference here is dramatic in what these bonds are being used for. This is education, baseline education for Oregonians to develop a better workforce, to bring up some better workforce situations in rural communities, especially where for long it lagged, and a lot of rural communities don't have the financial base to get these projects done. That's why the one last session in Tillamook was so important to us, and to a degree OIT faces the same situation, although they've done a great job with the local funds to match up. So I appreciate you bringing these forward. Thank you very much.
Very good. Further discussion? Objections to this approach? We'll have staff draft the corresponding language. Let's go back to the University of Oregon Arena. And the reason I'd ask my colleagues to indulge me for a moment would be twofold. There's been a lot of information flowing back and forth, much of it wrong, as we know, with all due respect to our media friends. But they've also brought up some key things I think need to be answered, because there are some questions about this, particularly this Eco Northwest study that was done in 2004. That's a very valid point, I think. And our staff has done some homework. We've seen it reported in the paper. I guess I'd like to hear from our staff directly and give our membership the opportunity to ask a few questions. Again, due to the questions that have arisen and some of the current concerns, I do think are valid. Both co-chairs have developed possible amendments to the bill that would increase the reserve capacities, and we'd like to offer those to you and get a sense of which way you would like to go. University has brought off on one. They're a little more skeptical of the other, but it would depend, I think, on the sense of this body as to which one we might move forward with. So with that, Mr. Bender, if you wouldn't mind talking a bit about your reevaluation of the project based on the study that was brought forward from 2004, sir.
Well, certainly, Mr. Chair. As you know, this project came before this committee during the interim at your January 2008 meeting. At that time, as the fiscal office does for all items that come before the interim committee, we prepared an analysis and recommendation of the funding proposal, the arena project, for you. In that recommendation, we did recommend approval of the project, and the committee at that time did concur with that recommendation and voted to approve the project, which is now in the amendments to Senate Bill 5555. The basis of our analysis was primarily to see whether the proposal that the university had for funding the new arena was a proposal that could be financed from revenues available to the university's athletic department. In other words, would there be sufficient funds to allow the arena project to have a reasonable chance of success without the need for the university to use general education funds or for the state to throw in general funds in order to finance that. By general education funds, I mean the general fund that you appropriate to the Department of Higher Education, some of which is allocated to the University of Oregon to support their programs, and also tuition dollars are a question. We found that indeed the financing would very likely be such that it would not be necessary for the university to use these other sources of revenues in the event that the project proceeded. Our primary criteria for evaluating that was to look at the revenues that were available and to see specifically whether specific gifts that were being pledged to the university's legacy fund would be sufficient to cover any operating shortfalls. And we found that to be the case. Subsequent to this, a report that was done by the consulting firm Eco Northwest was released that we were not aware of at the time, which projected a much lower rate of revenues for the arena than the more recent university's report. And even though LFO had used lower revenues than the U of O's consultant report had, these new revenues were even lower than what we had used. So we wanted to just see if this Eco Northwest report were indeed correct in its projections, would the project still be able to be operated without the use of university funds? And that is what we did. We basically looked at the information in the Eco Northwest report. We had to make some assumptions because the Eco Northwest report wasn't didn't anticipate an arena opening in 2010, but we tried to parallel the assumptions in that report as much as possible. We repeated our analysis, and it still turned out that even with these lower revenues, the project is still fiscally sound, given the fact that also since January, another piece of information has come out, which relates to the amount of advertising revenues that the university's athletic department will receive in a contract it is entering into. With the combination of these two factors, with that factor, even at the new Eco Northwest levels, the project still would not require any other sources of funds outside the athletic department. And based on that, we haven't revised our recommendation. It is still to approve the project.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, question.
Thank you, Congressman Schrader. Mr. Co-Chair. I'm sorry.
I get rid of it already.
Thank you, Steve, for doing that. And we received a letter, at least those of, I'm not sure if it went out to the entire body, but at least those of us in Ways and Means, from Mike Gleason, the former Eugene city manager, talking about the Eco Northwest report. And my understanding is that that report done 4 years ago, there was no site location. It was a different size, and it didn't support multiple uses. So that Eco Northwest report was for something envisioned that was completely different to that which we have before us. And so I think that's important. And I'm glad you did talk about the advertising revenue. My understanding is it's about $67 million of advertising revenue that you had not included in your calculus when you recommended it as positively, and that's in other words, this came later, so it even adds greater stability. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Galizio. We had included some projections for advertising revenue, but they turned out to be much lower than the university has since been able to demonstrate that it will receive. So we used the most recent numbers. We actually used $52 million of the $67 million because some of the revenues are intended to be dedicated for other purposes. So we used the $52 million. And using those numbers, even at the lower attendance and ticket sales that the Eco Northwest report would seem to project, there are still sufficient revenue that the university should not have to rely on any funds outside of the athletics department.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Steve, one of the things that we've been hearing is that the legacy gift from Phil Knight and some other gifts, as I understood from the testimony, was like $107 million. The question that people have been asking is that a sure thing? Is that gift there on the table, going to stay on the table, or can we, what can happen to it?
These represent, the $107 million represents a portion of the total pledges that the university has been receiving for this fund. Those are the pledges which I believe are committed. I think that's the term. So we do expect at least this amount of money. The university is hoping or planning to try to raise additional funds for the legacy fund. We tried to evaluate the project on the assumption, to be conservative, that they were not successful in raising any additional funds beyond what they already had committed. And we just looked to see whether the project would still be financially viable at the current level. I believe there are people from the university here. I actually read in the room so quickly, I can't confirm that, but I assume there may be people here if you have additional questions about the donations.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Senator Carter, and Whitsitt, and Johnson.
Steve, for the sake of the record, would you explain the difference between X1F, X1G bond in terms of tax-free taxpayers' dollars versus the non-use?
Certainly, Senator Carter. Article 11G bonds are general obligations of the state that the Constitution authorizes you to issue for projects at either the Department of Higher Education, or Oregon University System as most people call it, or for community colleges. And the state, these become a general obligation of the state, and the state pays the debt service for these bonds, which typically have 30-year terms, but they can vary, from general fund appropriations. These require, in all instances, a general fund match. In many cases, the state has been requiring the institutions, either the community colleges or the higher ed schools, to raise their own funds, gifts or donations, to make that match. But the ongoing debt service becomes a general fund obligation. Article 11F1 bonds are also authorized by the Constitution, but you can only authorize them for higher ed projects. They're not available for community colleges, and you can only authorize them for projects that are not wholly self-sufficient and that are self-liquidating, which basically means that the facility is generating revenues and that the debt service is paid from those, and general fund is not then appropriated in the future to pay the debt service. For these particular bonds, the payment for the debt service over the 30-year course of the bonds will be the revenues available to the athletic department of the University of Oregon, including donations that are available that can be used for this purpose. One of the largest types of donations that are eligible for this category is the Legacy Fund, which currently has about $107 million in pledges that are committed. So that will be the primary source. In the event that there are insufficient revenues, then there are issues of other funds that the University of Oregon would have to draw to pay for those. But these are general obligation bonds of the state, and ultimately the state backs them with its full faith and credit.
So, thank you. So, Steve, would you also tell me that, because I know there's been a generous donation given by Mr. Knight, and the letter has arrived, and many legislators have seen it, and that, is that a letter of commitment that that in the event, the Holy Land event, that something happens, and that the money doesn't come in from the university, that this letter is a letter of legal recognition in the sense that it's holding that.
I'm afraid
finding is the word I'm looking for.
We've looked in our analysis. We have considered these to be committed funds that the university would have some claim for. Actually, I'm not an attorney, and yesterday we did ask legislative counsel to review the documents and to see, to make some type of review of the claim, and they have not concluded that as of this time.
Okay. But the public should be assured that the state general fund is not at risk for these bonding dollars that are before us now.
That is the opinion of the legislative fiscal office, and if indeed the Eco Northwest report projections prove to be accurate, and legislative fiscal does believe that this was a well-done report, it should still be the case that no state funds are necessary. There is, of course, no guarantee that even the level of revenues in the Eco Northwest report will actually be realized. We're looking at a 30-year horizon here, and there's some risk to the state and to the university, and if the revenues are not sufficient, there will have to be budget adjustments made, because these are bonds that are general obligation, and they will need to be paid. The debt service will need to be paid to the bondholders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, good questions. Again, we've got a lot to go through today, colleagues. Senator Whitsitt.
The question's been answered. My question was, is committed funds equivalent to secure collateral? Mr. Bender said that the LFO is, or legislative council is looking at that as we speak. So.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I guess I'm just going to nuance the conversation that's already happened. Is there any way to have the funds committed prior to moving ahead in some way to bring a greater degree of assurance to the state? I think it would be very awkward for a university to find themselves suing a donor, and I think that that's worrisome. So mine is a question of timing. Not knowing what the co-chairs are contemplating for budget notes, I am wondering whether or not the university would be willing to commit in writing that the source of revenues would come from the athletic department and would not emanate from these other sources like tuition or funds that are appropriated to the Department of Higher Education. Those are the kinds of questions that constituents are asking us. I think they're confused about the operation of these bonds, but some declaration on behalf of the university about the source of the money, I think, would assure a lot of people who are quite anxious about the diversion of funds from academic endeavors to athletic endeavors.
I think we'll hold that till Representative Nolan gets to introduce, because that's a line of the extra reserve fund that we're talking about here. I'd remind colleagues, they have to come back for a whole new proposal. Just because if everything didn't work out, they don't automatically get state taxpayer money. This is, they'd have to come back with a different proposal. So let's go to Representative Edwards now.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Bender, there have been reports that issuing these bonds will limit the university's ability to fund other capital construction projects like residence halls. Is that the case or not?
Representative Edwards, it is the case that the State Board of Higher Education applies a limit to the amount of debt that each university is allowed to hold based on the size of its budgets. Within that limit are debt on all Article 11 F1 bonds. Article 11 F1 bonds are also the financing source used to support and to build residence halls, dining halls, and other auxiliary facilities of that nature. The use of $200 million of bonds would move the University of Oregon closer to its limit and thereby reduce the amount of ability to finance other types of projects of this nature. The university believes that the amount of bond authority that it has under the Board of Higher Education rules would remain sufficient for its needs, even if this particular project is approved.
And Co-Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative.
Do we know how close the university would be to its debt limit given the issuance of these bonds?
I do, and I'm afraid I just did not bring that information with me. I can get that for you before your tomorrow's meeting. I apologize for not having that here. Thank you.
Co-Chair Nolan.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, I understand that you prefer to hold a discussion about a reserve fund and how to fill it to after we've clarified the aspects of the project. So while I want to talk about that, I have just one point of information, really, Mr. Bender, or perhaps someone from the university system. I want to know the status of the marketing agreement. Is that a memorandum of understanding, or is that an executed agreement?
Can we get someone come forward from the university to answer that? First.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Price. I'm Vice President for Advancement at the University of Oregon. The IMG agreement, which is the marketing agreement, is a signed letter of intent between the two parties, and it's now being reduced to an actual contract.
With that, I'd like a follow-up. What's your timing for execution?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're working on that right now, and it's just a matter of working through the contract language. So I'd be reluctant to tell you how long the lawyers will take to execute the contract, but the goal is to have it done rather quickly.
Mr. Price, we're being asked to make a decision tomorrow. That would be the kind of timing that would be most helpful.
There you go. Senator Gorley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Bender, when will the Legislative Council opinion be available?
We expect that at any time. country. We did, it may be sometime today, we believe. I don't know. I haven't, I cannot answer that question for you definitively.
And then follow up, there have been references to the letter from Mr. Knight. Is that letter a part of the formal record?
It is not, Senator.
Should it be? That's a question for the co-chairs. The letter from Phil Knight, I'm asking a question about whether that letter should be a formal part of our record. There have been references to it, and I believe some legislators have seen it. I'm not one of those legislators. Should that not be a part of our, should it be a part of our formal record?
I guess I asked the university, is there a problem in producing that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Alan Price, we have traditionally asked not to be in a position to have to make available publicly letters of intent from donors based on their own privacy. However, in this case, we did make the letter available because of the fact that there is such a connection between the action that the legislature is being asked to take and the presence of the Legacy Fund and its commitment. So if that were important to do, the university would be prepared to do that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your help there. And we have Senator Bates.
Just a couple quick questions, Tocqueville. Steve, have 11F bonds ever failed? Has general obligation bonds ever had to be backed up?
I am not aware of a situation where that has occurred. I don't know if anyone from budget and management is aware of that situation or not.
Treasurer, like to cut. Treasurer's out. Anyone want to come forward and?
No. There's the treasurer is reporting that no, that is not
there. So in the history of 11F bonds, they've never failed. That's the point I want to make. Second question, the last question is, we've seen a dramatic drop in interest rates in the last 2 or 3 months since we first looked at this project. And I realize these bonds will be sold sometime in the future. If interest rates can either go down or stay down, will that affect the cost of this in a positive way for the university?
Certainly, Senator, the cost, the interest rate, the lower the interest the bonds can be issued, the lower the interest rate at which the bonds can be issued, the less debt service costs the athletic department budget will be responsible for, and that will be a benefit to the institution.
Very good. Senator Johnson, last question.
Thank you. I guess given that Dr. Prinsteiner is here in sort of a target of opportunity, I would like to respectfully address a question to him to get as part of the record. Would that be acceptable to co-chair?
Yes,
if it's relevant.
Well, my question is, we have heard a lot from the neighborhood associations about their concerns, and I would at least like your comment on the university's willingness to create a forum whereby those concerns could be heard and addressed. The question of parking looms large, and I just don't know to what degree you're actively working with some of the neighbors who feel aggrieved about addressing concerns that might profoundly change the character of their neighborhood.
Co-chairs, members of the Senator Johnson, yes, I am aware of that, as a member of that neighborhood. Yes, there was a forum last night, and I think there will continue to be a lot of discussions over the course of the next several months as the plan for the arena evolves. I know that, and I spoke with Mr. Price earlier this afternoon, the university is committed to working through the issues of parking, of litter, of noise, and there was a fourth one that was raised last night. But there are things that typically in most projects we do work through with the surrounding neighborhood, because they are the impacts that one would expect. And I think that kind of thing will be worked through, and my hope is to the satisfaction of most, if not all. But I don't know that most will be satisfied, but hopefully we're going to work through.
That's all the people I have asking questions, but Chancellor, you might stay there. As the co-chair has referenced, and I think I've been pretty clear, actually since our January meeting, I have worked with the chancellor's office and with the university system to put some suspenders on this belt, if you will, out of my concern to protect the general fund and the academic budget for the university. President Frommeyer has provided a letter. Essentially, I asked them to create a reserve fund, which would be available to make debt service payments should the revenues not be sufficient, should the legacy fund earnings and available principal not be sufficient. This would be yet another backstop before they have to go to general and academic revenues. And the president, President Frommeyer, provided the co-chairs a letter which I thought had been copied to all of you. And Senator Johnson's line of questioning makes me wonder if somehow that letter did not get to all of you. But do you have copies?
I can distribute now if you want.
Mr. Bender, that's perfect. Essentially, they have agreed to create a reserve fund to provide that backstop, which they proposed. I didn't ask for particular funding for it, but they proposed to fund with a $1 surcharge on all ticket prices above an $8 ticket. So essentially free or very low-cost events would not have to pay this burden. And would accrue principal in that fund up to an amount that's specified here, but basically I asked for a full years of debt service requirement, not expecting that there would ever be a year when the athletic department could make zero payments, but there might be years when they couldn't make the full amount. So this would probably cover this for several years if the team or the department goes into a slump. And so in 30 years, it's bound to happen. So that's what they've come back with. It is a substantial commitment from them, and I think it answers my concerns about protecting the general fund, and I would recommend it to you. It would be my proposal, and I think at some point the co-chair and I want to have some version of a reserve fund in the bill that we pass so that we trust and verify. So that's my proposal.
My issue, co-chair, we had heard somebody, there's some issues about arbitrage in there. Is that an approval? I know very little about that, but there was some maybe penalties from the federal government on issuing these bonds or something.
As I understand it, and I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong, because the treasurer's office is here. We've talked about that issue with the treasurer's office. We've talked about it with bond counsel. And we've talked about it with the university system. The reserve fund can be established in a way that does not present an arbitrage problem. The way to do that is we have to limit the amount of earnings it can earn, because if it earns at a higher rate than the interest rate on the bonds, that's where you get into a problem with the IRS. So we'd have to invest in more secure kinds of T-bill sorts of things that would not be as aggressive an investment, but we could address that, Senator.
Thank you.
This would be, I think, the preferred alternative by the university to secure things. Another alternative for consideration is, as you know, we did away with sports action and now have a 1% lottery dedication that goes to the universities for supporting a lot of the programs that don't earn a lot of money. And University of Oregon gets, what, $3.1 million. Some of that, about $300,000 plus, goes to academic scholarships, which you wouldn't want to touch, but there's a significant amount that goes to women's programs, some of the non-popular sports programs. But in a crunch, another alternative is to have, if the fund, legacy fund or whatever, falls down to about $12 million, pick a number, that some of the money could be diverted out of University of Oregon's portion there to fulfill the debt service or work towards that debt service obligation too. So, but that's.
We would not want to play against University of Oregon women basketball team.
I guess I have a clear understanding about the priorities here. Okay. So, any problems, any heartburn over the reserve as presented by Representative Morgan?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the diligence that the co-chairs have put into this project. I think that the $200 million price tag kind of caused all of us. You would see the whites around our eyes as we worked our way through trying to grapple with the intricacies of this. I have a great deal of faith in Mr. Bender's analysis, having worked with him for many years on funding projects in higher ed. I found him to be very thorough and very conservative in the way that he looks at projects, and so it is important to me that under all of the funding scenarios that that this pencils out, that really we can't find a funding scenario at this point that doesn't cover the cost of the debt service on the building. I also appreciate the OUS system and the carefulness with which they go through these proposals to make sure that they hold water economically, and I've worked with the system for many years on capital construction projects and been very impressed with how they deal with putting a bunch of different scenarios on the table and coming up with something that really, from a fiscal perspective, does hold water. I appreciate the co-chairs wanting a reserve fund in here. I think that we have ample discussion that there may not be a need for it, but given the dynamic of the project and the size of the project, it probably is prudent and it probably does give people a measure of comfort. I would prefer the proposal that was brought forward by Representative Nolan, because I know how important those sports programs are for some of the people that are involved in them. And my daughters took advantage of those programs when we went through the system, and they're good character building and good team building experiences for young women. So my personal preference would be no additional reserve at all, but I would be very happy to go with the $1 surcharge on the tickets. I think that this is a project, and we've had this discussion before in the interim, this is a project that has significance far beyond the University of Oregon campus, and it is going to be a great addition to Southern Oregon's ability to attract. It will essentially be the Rose Garden of Southern Oregon, and it will give us a whole new platform to take meetings and conventions and things to.
Is there a general consensus to that approach, or see some objections? Objections, Senator Johnson?
Not an objection, but just a question. You said that there had been two proposals offered. This is one of them. I'm just curious.
Senator Carter euthanized mine.
Okay, that was the second proposal.
Yeah.
So we'll have staff follow through then on that at this point in time. I appreciate all the work. Hopefully, it's an opportunity to educate the state of Oregon about ARC 11F bonds, and I appreciate the diligence by the media, actually, in all seriousness, to make sure we do the right things for the right reasons. So that's actually very, very helpful, and hopefully with the additional safeguards and the questions that have come up as the project moves forward, everyone's on notice that it better be done well and done right, and we'll probably be keeping track of it. Yes.
Just one more small thing. I really do appreciate Senator Johnson's comments about the impact on the neighborhood, and it is my hope that the university will work very seriously with those people, because I think that we've seen many, many times that when people don't have factual information to operate from, they go naturally to a worst-case scenario. And I think that this could be formulated to be a win for the neighborhood and a win for the university.
Thank you very much. Well, we're not moving anything right here today, so we can move forward. Thank you very much, Brittany. Thank you, everybody. All right, I believe that's it on our bonding bill.
Sure, Mr. Co-Chair, we will hopefully have amendments to you tomorrow for your approval, final approval for this bill.
Let's go.
Yeah. Senator Morse has joined us, colleagues, and he had, I believe, wanted to testify or at least talk a little bit about Senate Bill 1099, which is at the bottom of our agenda. Would it be acceptable if we went out of order and took his testimony, and unless there's a little hard for him, we can move forward. Yes, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I thought Senator Morse was here to make sure that the new arena would guarantee that the Ducks basketball program would be at least as successful as Oregon State's baseball program.
Watch it.
Well, we won't entertain that line right now, but that should be a lively one. So let's move to the work session on Senate Bill 1099. We've all, I believe, discussed this both on the House side and the Senate side. It's the leadership's desire that Senate Bill 1099 will be the vehicle that moves forward. Both the House and Senate bills were the same, and this one happens to be the one that we're going to be moving forward to reflect our desire for a little more accountability and actually some thoughtful continuous improvement. Senator Morris, why don't you actually lead us off on this?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, President Co-Chair, and colleagues. I really appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. And I suspect that brevity is a virtue,
yes,
looking
sir.
At your agenda and the hour of the day. This is a bill that succeeds Senate Bill 1039, which found great favor last session in the Assembly. It had nearly unanimous support, in that I think there was one member that did not vote for the bill. The governor, however, did not favor this bill and vetoed it. And so what we did is, in the interim, again, and my hat's off to Ken Rocco and his shop, Don Farr, George McGotten, and Rick Gardner, representing BAM and the executive branch, crafted legislation that you now find in Senate Bill 1099. You also passed on your floor House Bill 3613. The difference between the two bills is you'll find in the language in some very simple words. The previous bill was more of a directive nature coming from the Committee on Performance Excellence. This bill...
From last session.
This bill, you will find the language advises and assists in a manner that the governor finds is not intrusive into the executive branch in terms of the operation of the executive branch and the responsibility for that. One thing that was left unfinished in last session's bill was how will the $2.5 million of continuous improvement funds be appropriated, and from where will that process recommend assistance for continuous improvement within government. So this bill reaches out, and I think in a way that the governor is on board with. We had two amendments to the bill. One was to include two members from frontline workers, which I 100% endorse. The other change that you'll see in this bill versus the one that was passed off the floor of the Senate deals with when the Secretary of State makes audits of agencies, there's a requirement that those audit reports come to this committee, and that executive branch or the agency with respect to what their findings were and what their plan is to correct deficiencies. This bill requires a reporting in 3 months and a specific action plan in 6 months. The 3613 wrapped all of that up and compressed it into 3 months. I believe that allowing 6 months allows the opportunity for a more thoughtful response for an action plan for a deficiency that the Secretary of State would find. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I think maybe I could just end right there, and I suspect that that's enough.
Yes, sir. That's actually very excellent testimony. Thanks, Frank. I appreciate it very much personally.
Thank you
for your work on this. Further discussion? I think we pretty much know the drill. Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, are you ready for a motion?
Yes, ma'am.
I move Senate Bill 1099 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Further discussion? Objections? Seeing none. We'll get Senator Morse down here more often to make things happen like that. Appreciate that. Thank you, sir.
Representative Riley should carry that.
And we'll have Senator Morse carry it on our side. All right, let's go to the Senate Bill 5555, the Capital Construction Bill, and have have Mr. Hill lead off again for us, if he wouldn't mind.
Sure, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 5555 is the capital construction expenditure limitation bill. And there are, again, as there was in the bonding bill, there are a number of items in here that have already been approved by the committee. There are also four items which have not been approved by the committee. The first one is dealing with the statutory requirement to notify the body, and the military department is going to take an action, and there is a memo attached to the in your packet. If there are any questions on this, we have John Gordon from our office would be happy to answer those. But basically, it's just meeting a statutory requirement and notifying the body. The next item has to deal with data center conversions. That was approved by you during the December 2000 meeting of the Interim Committee. The next one is a question that's been before this committee on a couple of occasions. It's the capital construction limitation for the group homes for the developmentally disabled. The next two are for the Department of Higher Education, the UofL Arena, which just discussed. The other bill was the bond proceeds. This is the limitation to actually spend the funds. The OIT health professions, again, in the previous bill, you okayed the bonding. This is, again, just giving them the limitation to spend the funds. And the same is true with Clatsop Community College. The $4 million is, again, their expenditure limitation to expend the funds that you approved in the previous bill. The rest of the items on the list, owing for $6 million, the aviation, which you just heard recently in the session, as well as the Sisters Maintenance Station, have all been approved by the committee during the special session.
Very good. So let's go back up to the top. The only new item at the very top in the military department is Klamath Falls Armory proposal. Is there any discussion on that? Any controversy on that?
Mr. Co-Chair, I just wanted to clarify on the proceeds being used to support their other capital programs.
Why don't you give us a run-through on that? Because we haven't seen this before.
Chair Nolan and members of the subcommittee, or members of the committee, pardon me, by statute, the proceeds from any Oregon Military Department real property sale are to be deposited in their statutory capital construction account and to be used for capital construction related items. So in this instance, the department anticipates building an Armed Forces Reserve Center on the Kingsley Air Base in Klamath Falls, and they anticipate a small state portion of that cost. And so the LFO recommendation is saying that prior to the department's use of these proceeds for anything else capital construction related, they must first meet their obligations for this new Armed Forces Reserve Center.
Clarification. Further discussion.
This is a sale. I mean, the climate falls saying there's no figure there. This is a sale, so we don't know what the figure is.
Co-Chair Schrader and Senator Nelson, the department at this point has a letter of intent with the city of Klamath Falls, and this is a complex exchange of values. The net cash proceeds are anticipated to be anywhere between $500,000, which is I could probably categorize for the department as most likely, up to the appraised value of the armory itself,
$1,000,003. Thank you. Thank you. Further discussion? Okay, we'll include this then in our omnibus bill tomorrow. Data center, I think we've covered, unless there's Harper in there. The group homes caused some questions. Ms. Baker, you want to, or whoever's appropriate, Mr. Britton, come forward. This actually, I think, is pretty straightforward. We just got wrapped around the axle a little bit the other night, but let's get clarification so we're all comfortable with it. Mr. Britton, would you
Mr. Co-Chair and members, the department in its rebalance included about $929,000 of general fund to pay for two new group homes that are needed because in the Oregon State Hospital replacement project they are being displaced. The $929,000 general fund should go into the capital construction budget, hence it is in Senate Bill 5555 as our recommendation.
I guess I'll ask the question, if they're being displaced, does that mean they have nowhere to go?
Mr. Co-Chair, I don't know if they have nowhere to go, but they will go into the new group homes.
Thank you. Further discussion, concerns about this? Very good. We'll have you come back again, too. Thank you. That's good. Colleagues, the rest of these items we've already covered in our previous discussions, unless there's a need to discuss the limitation issue under the capital construction bill. Are there any objections to the items listed on the sheet that will go on Senate Bill 555? I see none, so I guess staff has some direction for the final amendments for that bill tomorrow. All right, let's go to work session on the budget reconciliation bill, Senate Bill 5556. I believe we're all going to have a spreadsheet that we're going to work from for this. Ms. Baker, you want to start us off, please?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 5556 is the omnibus budget reconciliation bill. In its original form, it included issues that the Interim Ways and Means Committee had approved in the first couple of meetings during the interim, things that were on the January agenda and that have been approved during session have not yet been put into the bill. So what we have, instead of amendments today for you to look at, is a spreadsheet that summarizes all of the adjustments that we would expect to be in the mill in the bill, assuming, of course, your approval of some items that you have not approved yet. So the approach I would like to take is just to walk through each particular item. The budget analysts from our office are here to provide you with more detail if you have questions. There are some items on this list that don't have funding attached to them but have positions or FTE. Obviously, those will not be amendments in the bill, but I included them here because you will see them on the budget report that accompanies the bill when it gets to the floor.
If I may, Seth, for the interest of brevity, I believe we're going to lose some members possibly around 6 o'clock, or I hope not, run through the ones we've already talked about at some length and then flag the ones that are perhaps new to the members, if you wouldn't mind. And we can help you do that.
Mr. Chair, I will do my best for that. Starting with the Department of Education, you'll see there are several grants there for which federal funds are attached. I believe you have discussed the state school fund donations. Those are the kicker tax refunds and other donations. There is a proposed fund shift in the state school fund using $20 million of lottery funds to replace $20 million of general fund. So there's no net impact on what schools actually receive in a distribution. It's just a funding shift, and that frees up general fund for other uses. And then there are some position adjustments shown there. The next item is the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. This is a small amount of funding as part of the Department of Human Services rebalance was proposed to move over to the Student Assistance Commission from the Student Child Care Program. The Department of Human Services, I've shown the agency rebalance number there. That is a net general fund reduction, and I'll talk a little bit about where that general fund goes to. There is also an other funds reduction and a federal funds increase. Included in that net reduction is funding for 214 child welfare positions. This was discussed with the committee previously. That includes 136 currently filled positions on the child welfare side that were funded in the department's rebalance, as well as 78 social services assistant positions that were abolished as part of a reclassification package in the department's budget. The $7.3 million is $1 million short of fully funding all of those positions for the balance of the biennium. So our proposal would be that with this amount of funding, that the department go ahead and fund all of those positions at a lower level of FTE, recognizing that at some point, if additional funding is not provided through a further rebalance or other action, that some of those positions then would have to go away. But it does give them time to figure out what they're going to do relative to their McKinsey & Company child welfare staffing study that you heard about and the federal child and family services review.
Question, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, those restored positions include the SSAs?
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Monroe, yes, it includes 78 positions. It includes all of those positions. As I discussed, the funding is a little bit short of fully funding all of those for the biennium, so we would expect the department to come back at some point with another plan. But for this, at this time, this would restore those positions effective in March.
Thank you.
Question, Representative Morgan.
If you would indulge me to just go back to the Department of Education section. The line item that switches general fund to lottery fund for $20 million, can you talk about why that's necessary to do?
I would ask that Darren Hamilton's in the room.
Instead of Darren passing the buck to everybody else, we get him to actually answer
Mr.
questions.
Mr. Chair.
That's very good, Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, I didn't realize you wanted to, I thought you wanted to go through the whole thing and ask a question later. I had the same question. I'd also like to know whether $20 million is being used for, so maybe I can include that in the question.
I think we can ask questions as we go unless we get horribly bogged down. I apologize for not making that clear.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, I'm sorry. I was engaged in another conversation. I think I know what your question was, but could you please repeat
it? I'd be glad to repeat it. I'm just looking at the line item that says State School General Fund to Lottery Fund Shift for $20 million, and I'm wondering why that takes place.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, that is not an uncommon thing for us to do. Discretionary lottery funds are able to be used in the state school fund, and there is some excess lottery funds, discretionary lottery funds. We are net zero to the state school fund. It's just changing the color of the money, if you will. The lottery funds are being used instead of general fund.
So what I hear you say then is that there was $20 million in lottery funds that were unallocated to anything else?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, that's the case, yes.
And so the $20 million of general fund that is freed up by this fund shift goes to...
Here's the question. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, it goes to any of the other uses that would be needed for the general fund.
Okay, thank you.
Clarification. That's the exact question I wanted to get to, Mr. Co-Chair. So where did the $20 million go?
Yeah.
Is it in the ending balance? Is it being used for the rest of the omnibus bill? Is it being spread across?
All the above.
Mr. Co-Chair, if you will, the general fund is the general fund. To say where that exact $20 million went, it's being used as part of the
it's not new money.
No,
it's fungible money, sir.
Yes, it's just being used as part of the budget to go.
So just to clarify, Mr. Co-Chair, would it be a fair statement to say that the $20 million general fund that's being switched out of the state school fund is applied in other areas of this bill?
I'm sorry, I missed that. I was engaged in another conversation also.
With an eyes again.
I would be glad to repeat.
Yes, ma'am, please.
The question is, would it be a fair or a true statement to say that the $20 million in general fund that's being freed up by this fund transfer is what funds some of the additions to the rest that are aligned in the rest of this?
To the extent that lottery funds funded some of them, that would be accurate.
That money is, as my understanding is, that money is used to do the two things that have already been identified: pay for additions to services, to appropriations to agencies, but also preserve some modest, painfully tiny ending fund balance in the general fund.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, excuse me, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I thought that's what it was, but if I can rephrase this for a little clarity, I hope. In other words, when we get all through with this, the general fund ending balance will be $20 million more than it would have been had we done it the other, had we not done this.
Mr. Kutcher, if I might, the general fund is a discretionary fund, and a portion of the lottery funds is also a discretionary. In balancing the budget, the general fund is used for a number of different things. Anything discretionary that you choose to use it for. Lottery funds are also used that way, except they have the exception that they can only be used for certain purposes. And all this is really doing is taking out of the discretionary. It's using the lottery, discretionary lottery, for certain purposes that it can be used for, freeing up the general fund to be used for any purpose.
Just to muddy the waters a little bit further yet. The goal here, this is something we do all the time, and while the lottery and general fund we consider in ways and means terms fungible money, we do have some restrictions to use of lottery. State school fund is one that we can use it for, school improvement fund. So if we want to have maximum flexibility as we go through the biennium, it's probably prudent for us to put the lottery dollars in areas where they can be used and free up that general fund into other projects or whatever so that we can use that as needed as we go down the line. We're not generating any new money here. As you can see, it's merely exchanging one type of money for another, so it's not a bunch of new money that we found. Well, I'd like to move forward, if I may.
Oh, wait, DHS?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, please. Go ahead.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely. Senator Winters.
On the, thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair. On the $1.8 million for the Oregon State Hospital Improvement Plan, will there be another document that comes out that has the special purpose allocation? Because the dollar amount that...
We'll see that further down.
Okay.
Good question.
Mr. Co-Chair, if you are ready, then I'll pick up there with the $1.8 million of the Oregon State Hospital Improvement Plan. This is the amount of funding within the department's overall rebalance plan that was discussed that would carry them through the first few months of that plan, add staffing. There is, at the bottom of page 3, where the emergency board special purpose appropriations that are proposed are outlined, there is an additional $4,870,055 proposed for the special purpose appropriation for continuing work on that improvement plan.
So the total is that 6 point whatever figure we saw presented by the department before?
Correct, the $6.7 million general fund. Then I also noted there that within the rebalance plan, there's funding for $11.8 million of rate increases for community-based care in the Seniors and People with Disabilities program, and those are to be effective July of 2008. This is an increase from what was previously recommended by our office, but it's my understanding that's the level that is to be funded.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, General.
Would it be possible for us to get a breakout of how that's going to be divided? Because I know there's the duty in it in there, and there is the assisted living facilities, and there's a lot of groupings, so it would be nice to have what the actual dollars are to each one of the groups.
We can get that for you.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, the next three items then on Department of Human Services are items over and above the department's rebalance plan, and that includes $500,000 for community health care delivery grants, $275,000 for the Children Wraparound Initiative, which has been discussed with the committee, and $150,000 for the community mental health assessment. Then in other funds expenditure limitation, there is $400,000 added for Oregon Project Independence. My understanding that comes from the Senior Tax Deferral Fund. And then related but not necessarily dependent on Senate Bill 1093, the Oregon Health Fund Board is receiving gifts and donations and needs additional expenditure limitation of $440,000 other funds. I would note for the Department of Human Services overall there is a general fund reduction as indicated. Much of that is going into the special purpose appropriations. Again, at the bottom of page 3, we talked about the special purpose appropriation for the Oregon State Hospital Improvement Plan. There is also a $17.5 million, what I would call a more general appropriation for Department of Human Services caseloads, costs, and program needs. So that is funded, if you will, by items that we identified in the rebalance plan, including things like the Medicaid management information system efficiencies, some services, funding for services in the vocational rehabilitation services area, some savings in the services for developmentally disabled people. And so those items made up what's going into the SPA, but that SPA, if all those items were funded at the level originally requested, that SPA would not fully fund those. So we're expecting the department to come in with a rebalance plan, as they normally do, with ups and downs. But there is that $17.5 million SPA to help address those issues.
So questions on the human services section here? Senator Bates?
More of a statement, Mr. Co-Chair. On the community health care delivery grants, I know a lot of people would be disappointed that more wasn't done, but considering overall budget requirements, I think this is a good compromise, and I appreciate using good common sense here. I would ask, and I think this is the appropriate time to say so, that the definition of a medical home be followed what is in the bill already, not to change that. It was very carefully vetted and thought through what these grants should go for, so we want to make sure that they follow the intent of that bill, which was a result of a lot of work in the interim of defining what a medical home is.
329?
Yeah.
So we're trying to get like definitions, that makes sense.
Actually, I think it is House Bill 3614 from this session that we will have an amendment to go into the program change bill to lift that language.
Thank you.
The criteria that has been worked out to lift that into the program change bill.
I think it would be an excellent way to handle this and not get into another debate over something where you don't need to debate again. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Sheila, could you please just briefly tell me what the Senior Tax Deferral Fund is and also explain what the purpose of the $400,000 OPI funds are for? Are they, is there broad discretion in that $400,000 or is there a purpose?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Shields, I'll ask John Britton to address that.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Shields, the Senior Property Tax Deferral Account was established a long time ago, and in 2005, Senate Bill 870 took a portion of that account and dedicated it to the Oregon Project Independence Fund. And That money is available. There is a balance to the OPI fund, and what we're proposing here is to use $400,000 of that fund to augment the OPI program right now. Originally, in the rebalance, the department had included $400,000 of general fund, and that's not being used. Instead, we're going to be using other funds. The purpose of the $400,000 was to pay for the additional costs for home care workers.
Great, thank you very much. Representative Jensen and Senator Gordley. Yes, sir, you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. In relationship to the DHS caseload cost, program needs, et cetera, that we have there, this the projected costs that would be coming out of the agency's estimates for getting caught up with the DOJ's, U.S. DOJ's edicts or, you know, is that specifically what we're looking at with that?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Jensen, the special purpose appropriation for the Oregon State Hospital Improvement Plan, the almost $4.9 million, is what would be used to address the Department of Justice's findings out at the Oregon State Hospital. The other appropriation would be for more general needs within the department, and some of the things that they've identified already were things like the efficiencies associated with moving to the Medicaid Management Information System. They had some needs in the vocational services side, some savings on developmentally disabled services. So there are a number of things that made up that 17.5, but for tracking purposes, the Oregon State Hospital issues have their own separate special purpose appropriation that we're proposing.
I'm not sure that I got the end there. Then the improvement plan, the 4.9 plus or minus change, is the amount that we have set aside here to deal with the Department of Justice's findings and to update the hospital to a point that we'll start to catch up on services. Is that correct? And I don't know. I see Ms. Goldberg here, and I should probably know the numbers on this, but I'm sorry, don't. Is this an adequate number, in terms of what our needs are going to be for the rest of this biennium there? And I assume it is, but I'd just like to be sure of that before.
Sure.
We move through it.
Mr. Brigham, you want to address that?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Jensen, if I may clarify one thing. Ms. Baker pointed out that there is $1.8 million of general fund that is going directly to the agency. There's a listing here on the second line that says 7.3 child welfare positions, 1.8 OSH improvement plan, 11.8 for SPD rate increases. All of those amounts, if I'm correct, Sheila, are staying within the DHS budget. They are not part of the special purpose appropriation. But in addition to the 1.8, there is another special purpose appropriation, and it's at the very bottom of page 3, for $4.9 million to address OSH issues. So the total is about 6.7, which is the amount we your committee talked about the other day.
Thank you. I should have seen through that there, but I appreciate the clarification.
Thank you. Very good clarification. All right, let's move on.
On the criminal justice...
Excuse me, I'm sorry, Senator Gordley.
Oh, that's all right. No, it isn't. No problem. I do want to comment on the community mental health assessment and the $150,000 because it's very important. I'm pleased to see it here. I also wanted to just acknowledge Senator Carter's leadership in moving this piece forward. I also want to note for the record that there is a complementary bill still in Ways and Means, Senate Bill 1075, which would create a task force to explicitly focus on underserved populations, seniors, people living with disabilities, underserved racial and ethnic populations. And that bill, Senate Bill 1075, heard testimony from the Department of Human Services,
telling us that they could absorb the work within existing resources. So I want to get that here on the record and make the point that this is a bill that is should be seen as complementary to Senate Bill 1089 and 1075 also needs to move forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, I apologize. Anyone else? Senator Whitson.
Mr. Reader, at the risk of creating a little ire, I've been asked by a number of constituents, particularly in the rural areas, about the durable medical equipment. And I was wondering, given that we have not created any more money, but proved out more fungible resources through the switch in the Common School Fund, if there would be any way to appropriate any portion of that to the DME situation. That's particularly difficult in rural areas in that we're finding many people who are in rural areas are finding it more difficult to access that equipment. And where the bigger companies appear to be able to withstand the cuts better than the smaller companies, and the smaller companies tend to be serving the rural areas. So if there's any way that the co-chairs could address that, I would be grateful.
We have asked the department to look at ways to make sure that those providers that are struggling the most, maybe we can rearrange the dollars also with it that we currently have to make sure that they're as harmless as possible.
Thank you.
Further discussion. All right, I guess we can move on.
Okay. Criminal Justice Commission, federal funds expenditure limitation to collect and analyze crime data in tribal communities. There's a technical adjustment that moves general fund for drug court grants from this commission to the state police, and you'll see that coming into the state police budget on the next page. The Department of Justice issues, the first item there was approved during the interim for inclusion in this bill. Measure 49's claims processing, there's 1.9 million other funds added there. And then there's a technical adjustment to add federal funds for a violence against women grant. On the top of page 2, the Oregon Military Department.
Here. Yes, could I just ask a quick question? Is anything on page 1 not been adopted as yet? It's here, but has it failed to be adopted through the process?
Well, yes, a number of the items are new items that we're working through that we would have to adopt officially tomorrow that have not gone through the process yet.
Okay.
That's why we're going through.
And those are not being identified separate from those that have been adopted.
That's a good comment.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Oregon Military Department, I believe this is a new item. Emergency recovery loans to local governments, $500,000 general fund and $500,000 other funds is added for that. Firefighting costs, other funds expenditure limitation, this was for the 2007 fire season. And then there are two items with emergency management grants. I believe the number in the second item is increased significantly from what was originally approved, and the analyst would have to be able to address that. The last item is a fund shift for Homeland Security grants. My understanding is this is a technical adjustment in how the original legislatively adopted budget was put together and where those costs were shown. Department of State Police, Oregon State Police tree troopers, this is the funding that would add 39 positions in June 2009, $485,000 general fund, and then there's the technical adjustment there, the drug court grants coming in from Criminal Justice Commission. Housing and Community Services Department, I believe this is a new item related to Senate Bill 1073, preservation of low-income housing, $1 million general fund, and then that money would be put into an other funds account and then expended as other funds. So there's other funds expenditure limitation for that. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Mr. Chair? Yes, Representative Edwards.
To ask a question about the Housing and Community Services Housing Preservation Fund. Have you heard from the department whether they've been able to reprogram $1 million to ensure that we can take advantage of the unique public partnership that's funded.
There, we heard some preliminary communications in the process of drafting a letter about how they might go about identifying those funds. They were uncertain, I think, early on as to whether or not we were able to find $1 million right now, and I think originally expected this to be a June agenda item. So they're in the process, and hopefully by tomorrow we'll have that letter in our hands.
Okay.
The next item is Department of Veterans Affairs. I believe this is a new item as well. $300,000 general fund appropriation for seed money for a revolving loan fund for veterans small business repair loans. So there is also $300,000 of other funds expenditure limitation attached to that. Department of Agriculture has a grant related to animal trace identification, federal funds. Department of Energy, there is $1.6 million general fund proposed for OMSI debt restructuring. And then related to that, my understanding is with the governor's veto of the bill coming out of last session related to OMSI, the federal funds limitation attached to that stayed in the budget, but this takes out that excess limitation.
Other funds,
yes. Department of Land Conservation and Development, there's a general fund appropriation for the 30-year land use review for that department, and then an additional appropriation for Measure 49 claims processing, and that would fund some additional staff to do that work. Department of State Lands has $1.5 million other funds related to wetland mitigation projects. The Water Resources Department has a $2.5 million appropriation, and I believe this is new as well, related to Senate Bill 1069. There are two pieces to that. One piece relates to a study of the Umatilla Basin, and then there is a grant program as well. The Department of Aviation has other funds expenditure limitation for the second year funding, and I believe that the committee has already approved that second year expenditures, and then a little bit of federal funds for particular planning projects. For the Department of Transportation, there's $2 million other funds related to the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network project. This is match for some other funding for that project. The agency had a rebalance plan. I believe the committee approved that already, and those are the net numbers there. And then the Senate Bill 1080 impact is shown there as well, $1.2 million other funds, and then staffing associated with that. Department of Consumer and Business Affairs has some other funds limitation added related to Senate Bill 1064 regarding mortgage loan originators. The Board of Psychologists Examiners, you approved an additional position to address workload growth, so they have other funds expenditure limitation for that. And then in the Department of Administrative Services budget, there are a number of items that add expenditure limitation, other funds expenditure limitation, debt service for the Eugene State Office Building and the data center conversion, capital mall projects. The committee approved $3.6 million for fleet vehicle fuel costs, and then the Oregon Educators Benefit Board Benefits Management System, there is expenditure limitation associated both for the system there and then for debt service on the financing for that system. And then there is a reduction for Measure 49's claim processing, both general fund reduction and staffing reduction related to the department basically getting out of that business at this point. Department of Revenue, there is $1.3 million for the kicker refund administration. There is a reduction of $400,000 general fund proposed related to the department's and Oregon State Police tobacco tax enforcement. There is an increase in $529,000 other funds for a net increase in the department's budget. So that is an item that reduces general fund there but increases their other funds limitation to support those efforts. The Oregon Judicial Department has a total of $10 million other funds expenditure limitation, and you, I believe, have discussed the e-court project already. Public Defense Services Commission is just a technical position, an FTE adjustment. And then the Emergency Board special purpose appropriations that are proposed are identified there. Again, there's a relatively generic one for the Department of Human Services, one related specifically for the Oregon State Hospital Improvement Plan, and then a $1 million special purpose appropriation related to Senate Bill 1087, Property Crimes.
Thank you. Further discussion. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair. Going back up to the Senate Bill 1069, I believe in...
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Senate Bill 1069. I believe in scanning through that that there is a part of that bill that is contemplated to be included in the omnibus bill. Could you give us a short idea of what that is?
Yes. The breakout is what you're asking on...
I understand what is included in this bill, but it's my understanding that part of the provisions of Bill 1069 may be included in the omnibus bill, and I was wondering...
Well, this is the omnibus bill, Senator.
This is?
Yeah. We will be passing the bill out. What we've done in some of the bills, as I mentioned at the beginning, some of the bills won't move forward. They're not necessary because they're just appropriations. I mean, the housing bill is an example of that because that can all be taken care of in this type of document. There are others. We need the program language. 1069 is such a bill, and that's scheduled to move in a few minutes or half an hour, hopefully. And so we need the program language here, but the actual appropriations are done in this bill.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
Sure. Further questions? Seeing none. Any big problems with the Senate Bill 5556 as presented? Okay. Staff has some.
Of course, the committee members need a little bit of time to digest it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is why we're not planning to move those bills tonight.
Exactly correct. Okay, sure. We'll see
that
you tomorrow.
The fact that we don't have all the amendments yet.
Better detail. All right, the next item on the agenda is House Bill 3626, the Program Change Bill. And again, you'll see some overlap here, colleagues. Mr. Bender, would you please educate us?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The fourth bill that you're having a work session on today is House Bill 3626, which is the program change bill relating to public financial administration. Each session, or at least almost every session, and maybe be some exception somewhere, the Ways and Means Committee introduces a bill that is not an appropriation bill, but that contains program changes needed to implement the budget that's being approved. And this is the bill for the 2008 supplemental session that accomplishes that. You've had distributed to you two handouts, one which is a one-page sheet that sort of summarizes what is in the larger packet. And what we've put together here for you is all of the amendment language that is being offered for the program change bill, as well as specific information, summary information on each of these items. I would like to remind you that the structure of this bill is similar to the other bills that you have before you, the other committee bills that you have, in that the bill as introduced includes actions that the committee took in the interim through its December 2007 meeting. So everything that's in the introduced bill was previously approved by the committee. for the amendments, there's a split. Some of the things in the amendments were approved by you in January, and some of them are completely new, and I will try to identify each of those for you. But again, just to summarize, I know you have a lot on your agenda and it's getting very late. The introduced bill with a description of it has two primary components. There's a collateral pool statutory fix, and there's the establishment of a pre-disaster mitigation, a disaster response fund with the Oregon Military Department, as well as the elimination of an account that's no longer being used. I'm looking at page one of the bigger document. I just would like to note that the fiscal impact of Part B of this bill, the parts relating to the Oregon Military Department, do require adjustments to the Military Department budget to become operative, and those were in 55-56 that we just went through that Ms. Baker discussed. So those are elements that are already in 55-56. If you continue on, the next set of amendments, which are on page 6, which the description starts on page 6 of the handout, and the actual amendments start on page 7, contain two elements. Both of these were also previously approved, but in this case they were in the January meeting, and that's why they didn't get into the bill as introduced. But one is a provision that expands the authority of, expands the requirement for the Oregon Military Department to report on real property sales to special sessions of the legislature, such as the one that you are in now. The existing statute does not specifically permit reports to special sessions. The second item is an item that relates to your approval of the ARENA project. As you discussed it in January, your motion required a report that the University of Oregon be required to report on certain aspects of the progress of this project and projections for the athletic department budget. The amendments require two such reports in 2009 and 2011 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means on these issues. The next set of amendments that are being proposed are the Dash 7 amendments. The Dash 7 amendments have three components to them, and these are new. This is not issues that you dealt with during the interim in this committee. But the Dash 7 amendments cover three items. I'm sorry they're labeled C, D, and E here, but whatever. One of them is Medicaid long-term care. Medicaid long-term care community-based services. The amendments direct the Department of Human Services to design its reimbursement, to make some changes to its reimbursement for Medicaid long-term care community-based services. There's also provisions in the amendments that require DHS to consider a variety of criteria relating to the licensing of residential care facilities. And finally, there's a provision that ends a building moratorium on assisted living facilities that is in current law.
Representative Morgan has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Relating to page 9, letter C, the Medicaid long-term care community-based services, in looking at what appears to be the part of this that deals with it, which I think is section 5 on page 2 of the piece that's behind that, it talks about in cooperation with representatives of community-based care providers shall implement policies that offer incentives to providers for entering into Medicaid contracts with the department. What does this mean? I mean, does this mean that they're going to be able to design some incentives and then they'll have access to the special purpose appropriation to implement those incentives?
I think that there's someone here from the department and Mr. Britton from LFO who have been working on this issue.
And overall, Representative, I would tell you, Senator Carter and I were involved in this, and the purpose of this amendment is to give the department, in addition to the funding that we're proposing, to help keep
patients in the appropriate level of care, also to give the department additional tools that don't involve spending more money to increase the availability specifically of Medicaid beds. But Mr. Taves might be able to describe it more articulately than I.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, very quickly, again, we have this precipitous drop in Medicaid capacity in our community-based care system and a corresponding increase in nursing home caseload. So, I'm sorry, James Taves from the Department of Human Services. So what we're attempting to do here, in addition to the rate increase that was described earlier, is provide a different format for structuring Medicaid contracts that, to the extent possible, will get assisted living facilities and residential care facilities that are moving rapidly towards the private pay side to try to bring them back into the Medicaid program. And we're modeling potentially some contracts from other states where a program can limit its Medicaid liability and particularly target those people who otherwise would spend down, so they come in with their own resources, then they spend down. We're trying to look at a policy that basically says people age in place and they spend down in place and they're not then subsequently discharged simply because they're converting to Medicaid. And so we have some clear ideas about how to incentivize that and to limit the liability so they have a predictable number of people that could be on Medicaid that will accommodate people who otherwise would spend down. And then in the other parts of the amendments, as the moratorium ends, we don't want just a flood of new development again that would just, again, exclusively go after people with private pay, but that we would have licensing criteria that really allows us to negotiate with new development to say, we want you to look at underserved populations, we want you to include a Medicaid population and people that would spend down, so you're not taking people in, having them spend down, and then they're thrown back to us and we have no other capacity for them.
I think all of us are aware of the issues around Medicaid patients not having a lot of options left. And so what I'm concerned about is, was there money appropriated directly to raise the rates?
If we adopt the amendments to Senate Bill 5556, is that Senate Bill?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Then there will be. We are proposing additional funds to raise the rates.
Okay.
And what we wanted to do was give the department a non-fiscal tool as well to enhance the effectiveness of that. Okay. And just for the committee's edification, I'd like to call Mr. Carlson up because he was involved in the discussions around this amendment as well, so that if any questions about the provider's perspective on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We have been involved. Our members and our organization are committed to working to assure that low-income seniors and people with physical disabilities continue to have access to the services that they need, those who rely on Medicaid services. We have been involved. We have worked very closely with SPD and the co-chairs and others on the language in these amendments. We are comfortable with the language in these amendments.
Thank you.
Any further questions on that point? Thanks for clarifying that. I think it's important for people to understand it. Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I call your attention to page 14, the dash 8s. We've heard testimony this evening from two different people. One came from the Oregon Emergency Management Association, which I have a great respect for, and their criticism was that the dash 8s does not provide any assurance that the jurisdictions that are awarded these grants, that they would receive the full amount that they are due. Now, I'm not sure about why that suspicion is there. And then the next one was do not provide any assurance that the added administrative requirements will not delay the receipt of these funds. Also, General Caldwell testified that he felt that this bill was in flux and would be changed even further. So I guess my question to Mr. Minner is, does the Dash 8s in any way need to have any assurances here for the kind of the peace of mind of the Oregon Emergency Management Association, and will the bill continue to be changed?
and Senator, I want to hold on to that thought, but that's a new topic, so I think Mr. Carlson and Mr. Tate concluded their testimony. I didn't see any other questions about the Dash 7.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Can you answer Senator Berger? Or it's Mr. Borden.
I think Mr. Borden will be able to
Chair Nolan, members of the committee, and Senator Virger, I think if I can rephrase the question and see if I accurately have it, and that is one of the concerns about this measure is that it will delay the pass-through of payments to local entities. And LFO has looked at that very closely, and we believe there are six major safeguards to ensure that will not happen. You have just heard the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 5556. In that measure, the department is requesting $60 million in federal funds limitation. We are recommending over $15 million more in limitation as a reserve for future events so that the department can use those funds to make timely payment to locals. First of all, in addition to that, FEMA payments are on a reimbursement basis, and sometimes it takes years for those reimbursements to occur. So that we anticipate that the limitation given with this reserve would be sufficient for the department to weather short periods of time between emergency boards or regular or special sessions. The department can temporarily use other federal funds limitation within its budget for these short periods. And if the department needs limitation, let me step back. If Oregon moves to annual sessions, then that will be another safeguard. But the department should have plenty of limitation to make it, to get it to the next emergency board or a regular session.
You said you had six.
I'm sorry. I'll go through them real quick for clarity. Disaster payments are on a reimbursement basis, which means they don't need the limitation until they actually occur. The legislature could provide a reserve, and that is recommended in Senate Bill 5556. The department can use temporary limitation from other programs it has, federal funds limitation. The department can rely upon the emergency board, which meets quarterly, or it can meet on an ad hoc basis if necessary. The department can rely on the regular legislative session, which occurs well into the biennium before the biennium is through. So at the point when its limitation is the lowest, the legislature would be in session to be able to accommodate that. There is no doubt that in an extraordinary event, the legislature, and I mean a truly extraordinary event, the legislature may need to be called into special session to provide limitation. But this would be necessary for more agencies than just the military department.
I believe that is already in statute that we would be called into special session. I just want to say that these are the frontline people that are going to do the work for all of you and save lives. And so I want to just be sure that they have some level of comfort, and I greatly appreciate your giving me this. I don't know if they have already received that kind of response from you or not, but I do appreciate that. And my last question was, is the bill going to continue to be changed? Not necessarily this piece.
Not beyond, I don't believe there's any expectation beyond what we're talking about here today.
Thank you very much.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We did hear earlier that there were a couple of sort of technical but not insignificant changes that were being requested for this bill. For example, not limited to, I remember the phrase, but including but not limited to was one of the fixes. It's just a few words but makes a world of difference at times. And it also had to do with making sure that we're giving the authority to the right
agency or the right department for technical reasons. So I would have thought that we might be seeing some change to the bill. My primary reason for asking for recognition is the same kind of concern that Senator Berger has expressed. From what I've heard from more than a couple of sources, local government that's the recipient of this assistance, is they didn't understand what the problem was that was trying to be fixed. They didn't understand why there needed to be oversight on something where basically the state is acting as kind of a bank, might be passing through to them. They've incurred great expense from a disaster. We receive money and pass it to them. We're just a bank, and anything that puts additional hoops or costs in the way is suspect. So I, too, was hoping to seek clarification and assurance that of two things. One, that this doesn't delay anything at all, and second, that they will receive the full amount of money that had been requested, just as they would have before, that this doesn't in any way jeopardize the funding that is owed to them, because our responsibility is to get the money to them, not to re-examine it, count it, and then send it back a dollar short.
Chair Schrader and Vice Chair Nathanson, there is no doubt federal law and federal regulations take these funds out of the purview of the legislature. They are being passed through to locals per those federal regulations. The problem we're trying to solve is there are several, and one is Oregon does not have a statutory account right now for pre-disaster or disaster response. And so this is the beginning of an infrastructure to cycle these funds through these two accounts, clearly to differentiate them, and to allow us to see what levels of expenditures are happening. The one reason why we want to do that and is to help understand the general fund ramifications of these federal pass-through dollars, because they do have general fund ramifications as far as the Federal Emergency Management Agency's 25% match. So if we can clearly identify the funds that flow through these accounts, we can better identify what the general fund ramification is. And also we can it makes things more transparent for other activities such as mutual aid agreements between Oregon and other states.
Thank you. And there's no skimming off of a percentage for administration, I assume, of these federal funds.
There is not, unless allowable by federal law and FEMA.
Further discussion. Good points. Okay, I guess we can move forward. Mr. Bender? Question?
Just because all of this FEMA stuff is so fresh in my mind from the disaster in my district, you just said not unless it's allowable by FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
That's not quite the same level of comfort that I think some of us are seeking, to make sure that there's a clear path between the federal money and the recipients. And I just want to make sure that you haven't left open a door that allows for the siphoning of administrative expenses.
Chair Schrader and Senator Johnson, no. The measure clearly must adhere to federal and state law, and federal law trumps state law. And so right now, these funds do not change any process or procedure related to that, other than these funds now must be cycled through two specific accounts. The department is already making these expenditures, already passing through the funds, and what is allowable in absence of these funds is allowable with these funds. I hope I've answered your question.
If you would indulge one more comment. I just think that it's important while we're having this discussion to put on the record the fact that the military department, particularly in this last crisis, expended funds without any question. When people needed stuff, the military department and OEM were there. And I just don't want to leave the suggestion that somehow I'm ascribing ulterior, sinister motives to guys who gave and said, let's sort out the finances afterwards. So I just want to make sure that, that I'm, the motivation behind my question wasn't misinterpreted.
Good. Good clarification. All righty. Let's move on. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You're now up to, I believe, the Dash 9 amendments that are, there is a description on page 18. The Dash 9 amendments repeal three sections from last session's program change bill. That's to say the bill that was comparable to this one in that it contained not the appropriations, but the other programmatic changes needed to issue the budget were being passed. After the session was over, the governor line item vetoed three sections of the bill. This is apparently in violation of the Oregon Constitution, which limits the authority of the governor to issue to do a line item vetoes to only appropriation bills. So the impact of the Dash 9 amendments would be to actually remove from law the provisions that the governor had attempted to veto. We do believe that there will be no fiscal impact because the executive branch has been operating as if the vetoes were valid. So passage of this provision would not change their function.
What a difference of opinion with our friends in the center office, and we're just trying to avoid conflict. Continue.
The next set of amendments, the Dash 11 amendments, I believe are being withdrawn from consideration based on earlier discussion earlier at this meeting. These were the ones that would have used on sports action lottery funds for a reserve fund for the University of Oregon Arena project.
Thank you, Senator Carter.
The final set of amendments that we have here, and I believe there may be additional amendments coming, but they were not available to us at the time we put this together, are the Dash 12 amendments. And the Dash 12 amendments contain provisions that had been in House Bill 3625 during the supplemental session to establish a Veterans Small Business Repair Loan Program in the Department of Veterans Affairs. This program is established in the Dash 12 amendments. I have to apologize a bit for the fiscal impact information on page 23, which I believe is misleading. I didn't realize that there are actually in Senate Bill 5556, $300,000 in general fund for this program.
Very good. That would cover our...
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
I'd just like to reiterate that LFO has done a yeoman's job of trying to keep track of all this, but there may still be an odd amendment or two coming forward if need be to capture the notions of the bills that we have incorporated into the budget reconciliation bill and may need to end up in this bill as well. Specifically, we talked earlier about the criteria language from 3614 that needs to get lifted and put in here. And there may be others, and there is a technical fix that we may be looking at regarding the cultural trust and how not a change in money, but how the funds are appropriated within their existing appropriation.
All right. I think we've got clarity as much as we're going to get tonight on 3626. Let's move to work session on Senate Bill 1069 relating to water supply. Thank you, Senator.
I'm
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have at your place a fiscal impact statement for the Dash 5 amendments, a draft staff measure summary for the bill with the Dash 5 amendments, and then a copy of the Dash 5 amendments for Senate Bill 1069. The bill, as it came from the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, contained three provisions. It contained appropriation for a study in the Umatilla Basin on the feasibility of aquifer recovery. Also contained a provision for a water mitigation bank to be established in the Umatilla Basin, and had a grant program for the Department of Water Resources to help pay the costs of planning studies needed to evaluate the feasibility of developing water conservation, reuse, or storage projects, and had lottery funds as the funding mechanism. As you heard earlier, there are two components that would be included in Senate Bill 5556, and that would be for the $750,000 for Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recovery Study, and then $1,750,000 general fund for a grant program to make grants to help pay the cost of planning studies for water storage projects. The Dash 5 amendments then adjust the bill to remove the lottery bonds as a means to pay for the grants, as you'll be using general fund instead. It removes the creation of the mitigation bank and also removes the appropriations, as these will be included in Senate Bill 5556.
Questions and concerns by members? We've already discussed this a little bit. Need a motion to move the Dash 5s, I believe?
So moved.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Dash 5 amendments have been moved. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none? So we can move the bill to the floor.
I think that's a great idea. I'll move that.
All right. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll get Senator Bach in on the Senate side.
And I'll let you know on the House side.
All righty. Good work, Mr. Siebert. He had about 15 different amendment versions, so he was prepared. He was ready. All right. Next item on work session agenda is the Public Employees Retirement System. Mr. Cleary, welcome.
Mr. Kirchhoff, is this an information item only?
This is actually a work session on public employees' retirement. After that, we go to we have an information. We have one more work session on Senate Bill 1093.
Dr. Wilhelm. Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. I'm wondering about order, and just in terms of still several of us would like to go to the our other hearing this evening, which is the Oregon State Hospital program. I don't want to follow you up, but
no, that's I appreciate the comment. So then we'll move the informational hearing on the Oregon Health Fund Board to the bottom. The other two do require a work session, this one and then 1093. But that's all right. Thank you for your consideration. Mr. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first item from the Public Employees Retirement System is a required report. The board has a preliminary set crediting for earnings for 2007. By law, they have to report on those preliminary earnings decisions to give at least 30 days in advance of when they make the final decision to credit earnings from the 2007 calendar year. They prepare a report with that preliminary earnings crediting decision. The board will make its final crediting decision March 28th at its board meeting. And by law, they're here to ask that you acknowledge receipt of the report, and that is your LFO recommendation.
Very good. Further discussion? Sarah, you have something you want to expand upon for us here?
Co-Chair Schrader, unless there's questions, fine with that.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair,
yes,
I would move the LFO recommendation.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Further discussion? Objections? Seeing none? So noted. Thank you. Okay, we're going to go then to a work session on Senate Bill 1093 relating to health so that all members can get to where they need to be.
I think I have several people who'd like to leave. I'll figure it out.
Mr. Cleary, I guess we skipped over the work. I apologize for that. Is that Mr. Wyant? I made a faux pas.
We still have a work order.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. First one I've ever done, you know.
Yeah.
I apologize for that.
No, we wanted poor Mr. Cleary to wait through another series of debates.
Trying to move with alacrity, too much so.
Next,
Mr. Wyatt.
Yes, the next item on your agenda is the budget report for the Public Employees Retirement System budget required that they return to the legislature in the first and third calendar quarters of this year, 2008, to report on workload issues and how they're dealing with it. As you know, they've been stressed with workload issues since the reform legislation of 2003. They have prepared a report, which we have distributed to you, and they ask that you acknowledge receipt of the report, and your LFO recommendation is to acknowledge receipt of the report.
Just one quick question is, I assume we're leveling off in terms of needed the workload, if you will, since we're not introducing any new changes in last biennium. Is that, I hope, a possibility, Mr. Cleary?
Co-chair Schrader, members of the committee, Paul Cleary, director of PERS. In the report, we show the workload doesn't level off. It continues to increase. It's a function of demographics and of course, support cases. We did have, I think, 18 PERS-related bills that passed the last session. We've got some additional work that we've got to do in terms of our computer program associated with those bills. But I would like to point out for the committee that 2007 was a great year for PERS. We started off in February being recognized nationally as the public plan sponsor of the year, ended up December being recognized as the best funded pension system in the nation, and in between made some real substantial improvements on our customer service. And one final thing in recognition of the fact that I've got a number of members on this committee that were on my general government subcommittee. One of the things that they supported for us and actually added to our budget at the end of the session was some additional staffing to provide application assistance to people as they're coming through the process. And we've got some statistics in here that proved out your theory that us doing a better job upstream results in fewer problems downstream. People who've gone through that application had problems with 1% of their applications versus 11% of the general applications that we receive. So I think that's a kind of payoff on a continuous process improvement that we'd like to see in a number of other areas. So I just wanted to recognize that support.
That's outstanding. Very outstanding. Very good. Good work in the department, and some of the members here deserve credit for helping get things squared on.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
So noted. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none? So ordered.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we'll go to 1093. I apologize, colleagues. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1093. Late in the health.
I assume you want to hear from LFO first.
Maybe.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, what I'm handing out is two amendments and a draft staff news or summary in lieu of a memo on this bill. This was a bill that came to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means through the Substantive Committee. As it came out of that committee, it included an expenditure limitation and a transfer of general fund. And so it's before you today. We are proposing amendments, and there are two amendments before you because we wanted to, when we were looking at the bill, an issue was raised that we had one set of amendments drafted, and then the sponsors of the bill had some concerns with that, and so I'll talk about both of those briefly. If you turn to the draft staff measure summary, it says what the bill does. In its current form, it transfers general fund appropriation that was made to the Department of Human Services to the Oregon Health Fund and increases other funds expenditure limitation for the Oregon Health Fund Board. There is authority in there for the Oregon Health Fund Board to adopt rules. It changes the date of a required report to the congressional delegation, and then there's an emergency clause with the bill.
What the A5 amendments would do would eliminate the transfer of general fund appropriation, because in fact what has happened, the Department of Human Services has put the appropriation that was originally made to it in the Oregon Health Fund Board's account, and so there's really no transfer to be made. So as a technical issue, what the amendments do is clarify that that appropriation was for the Oregon Health Fund Board to start with. The A-5s eliminate federal funds language related to the Oregon Health Fund, and this is an issue that came up when I was talking with the Department of Human Services, because the language that is currently, that was from Senate Bill 329 and is currently in law, would have a problem if indeed federal matching funds were deposited into that account, because the feds generally frown on pulling down federal funds and putting it into an interest-bearing account, unless they, of course, earn the interest. So we were proposing to eliminate that language, and then we eliminated the other funds expenditure limitation increase that was in the bill as it came out of the Substantive Committee, and included that in Senate Bill 5556. So that was the $440,000 we talked about under Senate Bill 5556. So those were the A5 amendments that we were going to bring before you. After further discussion with Senator Bates, he is recommending the A6 amendments, which do all of the adjustments that we were looking for, with the exception of eliminating the federal funds language, because there is a perception that that language is an important statement of policy, and although we don't have federal money in the account now to get us into trouble, that at this time it's important to have that statement in the law. And perhaps Senator Bates wants to speak to that.
Good job. You explained it very well. I'm hours late in this complex. The original language was part of the roadmap, part of the guidance for the Health Fund Board to look at an option of putting in this fund Medicaid dollars. The language is obviously was may, not shall, because if we were even to try to do that, we'd have to have legislative approval. We'd have to have significant waivers from the federal government to do it. We know that. But we wanted to keep that discussion very robust and keep it going inside that fund board over the next 6, 7, 8, 9 months. So we wanted to retain, or we prefer retaining, the actual language 329, but make these technical adjustments we do need to make, and that's all we want to do. We have to have either the A5s or the A6s. One or the other has to be passed. And you know, most of us who worked on 329, myself included, prefer the A6s. We did not intend and did not intend and would not attempt to move $2 or $3 billion of Medicaid funds into that health fund board trust fund at this time. We didn't think of it. It's part of the discussion that's still continuing.
So would you like to move the A6s, Senator Bates?
I would, sir.
Motion's been made to move the A6 amendments to House Bill 10 or Senate Bill 1093. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none. Senator Bates moves Senate Bill 1093 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none. Senator Bates on her side. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's the end of the work session items for those that have to leave. I really appreciate them staying. We do have one last informational, I think we're at that point, yeah, informational discussion topic on the Oregon Health Fund Board and what we're doing at this point, and particularly with regard to cost containment. Mr. Spade, I appreciate you waiting this long, long evening to stay with us here. Thank you, guys. Yes, please. Reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 1093. Work session, excuse me, on 1093. Co-chairman, how do you vote?
Yes.
Very good, thank you. So, note any objections, co-chair? No, good. The work session on Senate Bill 1093. Mr. Spade, welcome. Thank you for all your work, sir.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader, Co-Chair Nolan. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. It's a pleasure to be invited to be here this evening. I have provided to staff some background earlier that I'll be going through briefly, and I'm also passing out a kind of a formal transmittal letter that this all gets together. I was instructed to talk about the Oregon Health Fund Board. In the packet that you have, I believe you'll see, I won't spend any time on this, but I have included a series of four monthly updates that we post on our website for stakeholder groups and the public that are watching the work of the Health Fund Board, which will give you a sense of what we've been doing. The board was appointed by the governor in August, confirmed by the Senate in September, and its first organizational meeting was October 2nd. So we've been at this for about going on 6 months now. But I was asked to talk specifically tonight, relatively briefly, about what the board is looking at in the area of healthcare cost containment. And I thought probably the best way to address that is that first to remind you that Senate Bill 329 did lay out 12 goals in a comprehensive reform plan, and three of those goals relate directly to rising healthcare costs, and I point those out in the cover letter. One, using proven models of healthcare benefits, service delivery, and payments that control costs and overutilization, but still emphasizing preventive care, chronic disease management, and using evidence-based outcomes and promoting primary care medical homes. Second, to fund a high-quality, transparent healthcare delivery system to be held to high standards of transparency and accountability that allow users and purchasers to know what they're receiving for their money. And then lastly, to ensure to the greatest extent possible that the annual inflation in the cost of providing access to essential health services does not exceed the increase in the cost of living. Those are in statutory language, and in creating the delivery system, the board has created six committees to help with the work of creating this plan, and we have a delivery system committee, and we have a charter for each of the committees as far as what the expectations of the board are of the committees in providing recommendations to the board in the weeks and months ahead. And the I've quoted here that, and the charter of the delivery system committee is one of my attachments, and we're really reinforcing the goals referenced above. That, and I cite here, the delivery system committee's recommendations will serve as a cornerstone to the success of the board's final report. I want to stop here for a minute. We had a board meeting yesterday, and I believe it's a unanimous feeling among all of the board that in any kind of comprehensive plan for reforming Oregon's healthcare system, whether you're looking at access, quality, or cost, the whole concept of public and private sustainability relative to year-over-year cost increases is really probably the most critical strategic issue that we as a state are dealing with, the nation is dealing with. We have businesses and labor representatives in our committees and on the board who are purchasers of care either through employment-sponsored or Taft-Hartley trusts. And I think probably many of you hear the same things I hear from the public. Those of us that have insurance are increasingly concerned about its cost and the cost of care generally. So this is really probably one of the most fundamental aspects that the board is focusing on. And in that charter, we laid out, and I've highlighted here six of them, we laid out at least six strategies that we want their thinking on, and I would note that the committee has been meeting and will be meeting tomorrow because the committee itself wants to go through a list of perhaps other strategies that would hold promise for long-term cost containment. But I'd like to, with the indulgence of the chair, just highlight the six that are in the charter and the underlying rationale. And some of these fit together fairly closely. Primary care revitalization is a major issue in this state, and it's a major issue nationally. Our primary care capacity, whether it would be primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, and others, is really shrinking at a time when we look at both the cost of today and the demographics of tomorrow, that we really need to revitalize primary care. Part of this, if not a lot of it, is in fact but you will hear me weave through many of my comments this evening, and that is we get what we pay for, and we are not appropriately reimbursing primary care today. But more importantly, there are emerging models. Some of them are actually being demonstrated in the state, but there are emerging models in other parts of the country and in other parts of the world that demonstrate where you have a very robust primary care delivery system built around the concept of either some will call it a primary care home, others would call it an integrated health home, where you have a team of multidisciplinary team of physicians, nurse practitioners, behavioralists, and others, that you can actually do a better job, a more cost-effective job in the management of where we know we spend our money right now. About 50% plus of the expenditures in healthcare today are in the management of chronic diseases. And in fact, we can narrow that down. Five major chronic diseases account for a huge portion of our annual expenditures. And we as a system in this country, but also in Oregon, are not doing a very good job, based upon the data available, of really aggressively managing chronic diseases. And if we manage them correctly, we have data that's emerging data in other areas that we can prevent hospitalizations, we can prevent referrals to more expensive either diagnostic or therapeutic outpatient services, and particularly in the area, for example, diabetes and asthma care, congestive heart failure. So we're looking at strategies, one, to how do we begin to revolutionize the primary care system in Oregon, and I would link that to number two, and at the same time improve the management of chronic disease. These really relate to the third item, which I think is the most fundamental underlying kind of principle of the strategy, and that is if we want to change the American healthcare delivery system, we have to pay for it differently. We are getting exactly what we pay for. The system is generally a fee-for-service system which rewards volume, when in fact most of this is patients, and most purchasers and others really are looking for how is an episode of care treated as far as outcome, as far as consistency with national benchmarks for clinical performance. It's really trying to build in a reimbursement to begin to move through and have a conversation among public purchasers and private purchasers and the delivery system, doctors, hospitals, and others, of how do we move to a new reimbursement system that pays for value-driven, high-performance delivery of healthcare. This is being discussed nationally. Lots of states are looking at the same thing, and the primary care chronic disease management is but one example of that. The fourth one relates to health information technology. American healthcare, while we've come a long ways in the last 3 to 5 years, and Oregon is a leader relative to the use of electronic health information, and I'm talking specifically about electronic medical records or personal health records, is that we know that that we are behind as an industry segment, if you will, other industries in the use of digitized clinical information and being able to move that information among and between providers on a timely basis to help with both the diagnosis and treatment. And so we're asking questions like, what is the appropriate state role to speed the diffusion of electronic medical records and other electronic health information systems, but more importantly, or equally importantly, is also to make sure that at a community level that there's interoperability, that those systems can talk with each other. In the state of Washington, where I spent 2 years before returning to this job, we spent a lot of time asking that question about what is the appropriate state role to assure interoperability. And as part of this, and we're working through a committee structure to look at models that the state can play that role to make certain that those goals are achieved. And I would point out we have some very interesting models just in the Northwest. The city of Spokane is completely wired electronically, but among its physicians, its hospitals, its pharmacies, and other caregivers, and it's completely interoperable. They did this kind of on their own, and we have some models to look at that we can move that forward. So why is this a cost containment strategy? And I'll get information through staff, Mr. Chair. There's some national data, and there's actually a study done in this state that evaluated what would be the total capital cost to have Oregon completely wired, to use my layman term. But what would be the savings that would be achieved by the elimination of duplicated tests, the more timely information of the transfer of information among providers, so that diagnosis and treatment is swifter and more appropriate. And there are net savings that people will, and again, I am a generalist and a layman at this, although I've done it a long time. There are people who will argue about how big the savings is, but I believe that there is general agreement there are potentially large savings there just by making the system more efficient and eliminating redos and those kinds of things. The fifth one is an area that I know the legislature here has looked at and we've done a lot of work at on. A lot of work has been done on a voluntary basis. There's a lot of work being done across numerous organizations. But the term of the trade is we need transparent data. One of the failures of American healthcare market is we don't have good data on performance, on clinical performance, on the efficiency of a system of care, relative to the expenditure of resources, on how consistent a healthcare system is relative to delivering on national benchmarks of care. For example, we have very good standards that are agreed across the country on what does it take to manage a diabetic patient or a group of diabetic patients as far as outcomes, proxies for outcomes. We have those standards. We don't, in a consistent way, collect those standards and be able to, one, share them with providers so that they understand where is their performance relative to others, and two, to ask the question from the provider, purchaser's perspective, again, whether it's a public purchaser like the state of Oregon on behalf of its employees or on behalf of Medicaid beneficiaries, or private purchasers, you're asking the same question: how do we know we have a value equation in this game? And until you measure it, you can't manage it, and until you measure it and manage it, you really can't say, are we changing the performance curve and are we getting the value? So we're looking across a lot of the work that's being done in the state, but trying to find a way to do that in a sustainable and coordinated way where there's, first of all, I think, to try to alleviate multiple requests of providers for the same information, but more importantly, bring it to the public's attention, to the purchaser's attention, to policymakers' attention of where we're doing a good job and where we need to improve, and be able to quite candidly put pressure on your where we need to improve clinical performance, or if there, and we know there are variations in the cost of care across communities, to understand better why are those variations there, and to have a conversation about it among those who pay for the services and those who provide. And the last one is probably the most healthcare economists will say that probably the biggest single driver of healthcare costs in this country is the introduction of new technologies. And new technologies are simultaneously a blessing and potentially a curse. One of the problems we have, and this is a personal opinion, is that we have lots of emerging new technologies, but the delivery system oftentimes takes years to understand how to appropriately deploy those technologies, and not to overuse them, not to target them at the wrong population. And what we end up doing is spending millions upon millions, if not billions of dollars nationwide, and adding only 1 or 2% to the value curve. And we have a consulting health economist, John McConnell, a PhD at OHSU, and he made a presentation to the board early on saying, when you talk about new technology, we don't want to be the Luddites. I mean, we don't want to be anti-technology. But we can do a better job in this state and in this nation to understand better about how to use the technology appropriately, what kind of clinical situations should it be used in initially, to build consensus among providers, payers, and others. And there are models for this in other states. Minnesota has had a public-private partnership looking at new technologies that includes all the leading providers of care, for example, the Mayo Clinic, all of the purchasers of care and payers, to understand how should we use this technology and get the highest value for the targeted population, but also at the same time not misuse it and really expend scarce resources in that. Those are some of those six are some of the ones that we're looking at. I believe the work of the delivery system committee, there will probably be others that are going to be added to it. In the charter, we indicated that this set of recommendations was not to be limiting, but these were the ones that we knew both from health services research and some of the reform activities in other states were where there were, you know, there was growing consensus about they were sound strategies. And there may be some emerging evidence that we can actually try to price over the long term what the return is. I would also point out in the charter, and this is I just want you to know that I do not have a passive board. The charter lays out some they have some real expectations regarding to any of the recommendations that come out of the delivery system. If you'll note on where we have deliverables and criteria, they're asking very specific questions of how long would this strategy take to implement? What's its life cycle? What, based on the literature that we know, what kind of projections on reducing the rate of increase of costs will it have? And so they're looking not just for straight policy perspective. They're trying to put this in the context of how do we better manage the year-over-year cost increases. Let me stop there. We're midway in the process. All the committees are working now. We've got over 100 citizens that are volunteering from across the gamut of interested stakeholder groups, looking at cost, looking at access, et cetera. We hope to have the initial recommendations of the committees to the board for a beginning conversation in late spring. We want to do some public meetings on some of the broad themes. The committee will develop, a draft plan in the early summer, take it out for public comment after Labor Day, and then according to the charter in 329, the job of the board at this point in time is to deliver to the 2009 legislature a set of recommendations that would be a comprehensive plan, and where the board deems it would appropriate, some proposed legislation in those regards.
Very good, Mr. Faith. Thank you for the overview. I apologize for lateness of the hour and bringing this to the committee's attention, but I think it's really, really important that we have some updating of what's going on. I hope we can invite you back at an emergency board meeting in the future. As you go down that road, we can give you more of our undivided attention. I think this is probably, as you said at the beginning, the most critical aspect of...
Thank you, and I've testified in several of the other policy committees, and I just say to the Joint Ways and Means Committee that as we move forward, I'd be happy to with the e-board or others to be able to keep you updated, and maybe we get up to small meetings with members of the board, because I think one of the important things is we don't want to drop a report on the 2009 legislature like here it is. We want to have some conversations about what's going on, what the thinking is, what the rationale is, because a lot of these issues are going to be policy choices. Mm-hmm. The board is really going to handle from what comes to their committee. You can do it this way, you can do it that way, because some of these issues are not consensus building. If we're going to do this right, there's probably going to be some strain and pain on everyone if we do it right.
Senator Berger?
Yes. Thank you. I enjoyed your presentation very much.
Thank you, Mayor.
How is the cost and the deliverables in rural Oregon a part of your process, or is it separate?
The issues of cost in rural Oregon, I mean, we're looking at right now, we're looking at cost in kind of the macro area, in the macro sense. I think you raise, and the board is already very sensitized to the unique nature of Oregon with both urban, suburban, rural, and frontier situations of where both the workforce issues, The availability of health care is quite different. We've had extensive testimony from representatives of the safety net that really serves much of rural Oregon. I would say that probably where we are, Senator Bridger, right now is more of a concern about access to health care in rural Oregon, having a workforce and institutions that are viable, because I think the cost issue is different in certain areas of the state, and the health policy issues are quite variable. And what I hear from rural Oregon is particularly making sure that there are that we have a workforce out there, and are there ways to build that through incentives? We've already done a lot of good work over the last decade plus in Oregon, but I think there's more to be done there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Do you have people from rural Oregon who are involved in the committees? I noticed on your on the list that you have here on the committee membership, 16 of the 19 are from the Valley, so an urban area.
We have tried, Senator. We have one member of the board is from Baker City, Dr. Chuck Hoffman, and in his practice in Eastern Oregon is well aware. In fact, he's worked with the local hospital, Mayor Baker. We have several committees where we have representatives either from the Office of Rural Health or representatives from communities. Not all. I mean, for example, we have committee members from Southern Oregon, from Coos Bay, we have a board member from Bend, and when we do, particularly when we do public comment and outreach, we intend to reach into all of Central, Eastern, and Southern Oregon, and the coast.
That would really be appreciated.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson?
Thank you. So I was very interested in your comments on emerging technology with the rapidity with which they depreciate. That's a major problem, and it's a huge problem in rural areas, not only because of the lack of caseload to actually justify paying for them, but also when they are used in an urban area, it becomes the norm to use them. You can't afford them in the rural area, and then your liability insurance goes through the roof because you aren't able to, quote, practice up to the standard. And so that's something that I would hope you were looking at and addressing, because it's a...
It is, yes, and clearly I think some of the, particularly looking at contemporary technologies, and probably all, I mean, the whole issue of telemedicine and around other technological ways to link urban care centers with rural providers, and more infrastructure investment in being able to have that. There's things underway in that. That linkage is going to be very important for the reasons you've cited.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Good comments. Very good comments. There was an urban-rural distinction and how you
right.
play that out so that you get good medicine and at the same time not set providers up for failure, if you will. I was shocked when I looked at this in the interim with Senator Bates and Senator Westland and some of the social men. It was pretty discouraging to see 25% of the Oregon health plan being in diagnostics alone before you even treated somebody. It was a daunting task to even get to line one in treatment past all the diagnostics. So, and the technologies, like I said, are great, but they end up practicing sometimes defensive medicine. And we have an opportunity based on some recent activities to think about how we can mesh everything together here.
Yeah, I think there's some interesting. I'd like to play. I'm thinking about what some of these other states have done, where you can build a consensus around the use of a technology in the near term when there are clinical questions about how actually to use it. Mm-hmm. If we could build a statewide a process where we have leading physicians, hospital leaders, payers, and others understand how to pay for it and how to use it, I think we can set up a system where we're much more rational and we're making sure it gets to the right patient, but we're also preserving scarce resources, and it would become a community standard.
The proliferation of it in urban communities, you have how many MRIs do you want in Salem? They get reimbursed by us, but you know, it gets to be very... So that's another issue that's difficult to deal with that we'll have to probably get into.
Senator Bates? Just a quick comment. First, I want to thank Barney for the good work he's done. He actually kept us on pace and on time so far in 329. know, we're all working on the edges of this huge problem of cost in health care and quality in health care. 329 is designed to really go to the heart of this thing and really try to deal with it in a global way, which no other bill does. But it's going to take some time. And one of our issues is going to be a difficult one. How do we communicate what's going on in 329 to the legislators before we go into session? We've talked about this. We actually had a meeting last week at my house over it. And what we're going to try to do is set up regular phone conversations with 3, 4, or 5 of you at a time as options are being made available to us so we can understand what those options are, because there are going to be choices. There will be choices of what we want to do to really fix health care. And we want everyone educated as much as we can before January. Not that you make a choice before then, but you have to understand what's going on and in a very complex field, what your choices might be, what your policy choices are going to be. There are going to be some tough ones there. Some real tough ones. The healthcare costs are skyrocketing again. It was on the news this morning, if you heard it. The consumer price index is going up because of energy costs and healthcare costs. So we've got to get this thing under control. There's no reason to be spending this kind of money in healthcare with the outcomes we've got. So we'll try to keep you informed. I know it's late, and thank you for staying so late tonight, Rick.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair.
Thanks.
We've had any other business before everybody? Rocco?
One thing, Mr. Chair, members, we have another report from DAS, Department of Administrative Services, on a comp plan change by law. When you're in session, they need to report these things to you. So we will hand this out to you so that you can look it over very carefully tonight, and we will take care of it tomorrow in the work session.
Sounds good. With that, we're adjourned. Good work tonight, ladies and gentlemen.
All your other late night time.